Okay, and welcome to episode 17 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob Galuzzo. Sitting with me is Mr. L. Rick Kane.
G'day. Hey, Rob. G'day. it's gonna be a blinder today.
Is it?
Yep.
Right on.
Wrap your laughing gear around this, love.
This is going to make sense
soon. Oh, God. Elric's going to do this all show now.
And I'll do his laugh.
Oh, I thought this is our tribute to, what's the,
Wake and Pray?
You're mad, you bastard.
You're doing a New Zealand accent, right?
actually, it's Irish, Ryan.
Oh,
Irish.
I see. Also with us is Rebecca McKendry, editor-in-chief of Blumhouse.com.
Hello.
Welcome.
What's up, guys?
And Mr. Ryan Turek.
Hello. How are you?
Order of pizza. He's feeding us tonight.
I am. Yeah. So if I duck out because my phone rings, I'm going to bring in
smart
pizza.
Move.
Sorry, listeners.
Smart move to feed us.
But if I could feed the world, I would.
He's also rocking a Phantasm badge, which is major props for that.
Yeah, right?
I love these pins that they've been coming out with.
Yeah. No, I'm a pin fanatic.
I'm going to give
a shout out. Did you see the ones that Fright Rags put out this week?
I didn't, but I'm rocking a whole bunch of Suspiria ones right now.
Oh, I want the Suspiria.
Yeah, isn't that awesome? It's the glass ceiling from the opening scene of Suspiria.
We need photos and we need to post these.
Fright Rags put out a collection of Friday the 13th victims, portraits of victims.
Wow.
So it's Kevin Bacon's like noggin with like the spike coming through it. And then it's got Larry Zerner and it's got Demon.
Wow.
It's a collection. It's a collection of just victims. And I was like, you know what? That's great.
I want one that's just a girl in a sleeping bag with it completely zipped up.
That would be amazing. I'm sure there, it's so funny because I follow so many like pin Instagrams that, and I post so many pictures of like the collection I have that people just start rant. Like I have strangers tagging me going, Turk, did you see this? Like this weekend, Halloween Horror Nights, Los Angeles. And I'm sure this is the same case in Orlando. They have their own pins this year.
Own
enamel pins. Yeah. So they have this like little Michael Myers.
Yeah.
And then they have one that's like the Titans of Terror, and it's like Freddy Krueger, Jason Voorhees, and Leatherface. And I was like, oh my God, I can't get to Halloween Horror Nights fast enough.
Everyone's questioning your geekdom again.
Well,
that's,
you know,
definitely not.
I don't collect many big things, but it's like little records, you know. But like,
if I had a denim jacket, I'd be into this, but I don't at the moment.
We got to get you a denim jacket, Rob.
You both do.
Yeah, this one, I've had this one since college. I just change out the patches every couple of years.
Come here.
It doesn't. I wash it like every couple of days.
All right. There's some cool stuff.
I wash it all the time.
All right. Fair enough.
You can wash it with the patches on, by the way.
This is my general horror jacket, like denim jacket, and then my black one is the slasher jacket. So it's like all slasher variety is represented on that coat.
If you questioned our nerddom at all, this is the episode.
This is the one.
To set you straight.
That's right.
Plus, we should be celebrating. This is the longest Ryan's ever appeared on our show.
It's the longest run, consecutively.
It's like you're finally a proper member. It's five episodes or something?
Yeah.
Together we are a Voltron. What have we seen this week? Let's dive right in. Anybody?
Excellent. I will start then.
Mm-hmm.
First up, I finally saw The Shallows. It was one of those that I kept trying to go see in the theater, and every single time I was like, I'm going to go see The Shallows this afternoon, and then something would happen on the site, or something would come up, or Marnie would break something, and life happened. I never actually got to go see it, so I was super psyched. I got advance of the Blu-ray this week for review, and it was amazing. It was much fun. I will say, and this isn't a spoiler, but when they actually show the full-size shark, is that a spoiler, guys? It's in the trailer.
There's a shark
in it. But when they finally do show the full-size shark, little let down. I was kind of hoping for something different. But that said, I didn't even care.
They can't all be Jaws, all right?
No, they can't all be Jaws.
There's enough room in the world for shark movies, yeah. And they can't all be Jaws, but they can aspire to be, or yes. They can get just close enough.
Yeah.
You
know?
Did you
or
want Roaring just... Shark from Jaws
no,
the Revenge?
I wanted a little less CG, okay. I think.
What are you talking about? That's a great looking shark.
It looked okay. When it got the...
I haven't seen it yet, yeah. So I don't want to get spoiled here.
I will say, like, compared to what we have gotten used to in the world of shark CG cinema... It looks brilliant.
Compared to Deep Blue Sea?
Yeah.
What was it? I love Deep Blue Sea, but the CG is terrible.
Oh, I haven't seen that in years.
There's a Starburst commercial that was on television in rotation probably like in the late 90s, which is around the time Deep Blue Sea came out, that it was like two sharks talking about Starburst. And they're like, oh, Starburst is fresh. And then they both slap tails and swim off.
I remember this commercial.
Exactly. And when I saw Deep Blue Sea, I was like, it's the fucking sharks from Starburst commercial.
Hey, Ryan, they got to work.
Yeah, I guess so. Sharks got to eat.
Commercials are where the money are. So, yeah, but The Shallows, it was such a trip.
So thumbs up for you.
Yeah,
okay.
Completely.
Let's just, before you move on, even the ending, because I think that's worse than any of the endings in all of the Jaws. We're not going to talk about the ending, but I think it's worse than any of the... I like the movie a lot, too. I thought it's really fun, but I thought the ending was so ludicrous. That even compared to, say, the worst Jaws ending?
You're out of your mind.
You like that ending?
I love that ending.
I thought it was well wrapped.
Are you kidding? You're kidding me. You have to be kidding me.
I cheered.
Oh, my God.
I cheered. I loved it.
It summed it up. And I will say that the climax is, it's unlikely, but did you just say you're the worst?
No, I said ludicrous.
Wait,
actually, no, you are the worst.
Though unlikely, I mean, the whole movie's kind of unlikely, so I think
I found the rest quite realistic. That ass! Anyway.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, Blake Lively's ass was definitely prominently featured.
She was great, though.
Yeah. So
it's also
then,
nice seeing A-listers.
And that,
in
by the
Marvel,
way, that one comes out September 27th.
Yes.
For those listening at home.
Yeah, it is coming. And the Blu-ray, it looked gorgeous, so highly recommend. Checking it out. I was not aware that Lucio Fulci had made a dance movie.
Murderock?
I had never seen Murderock.
Oh my God, the greatest poster of all time.
So I watched Murderock. Apparently, and then I got really interested on why Lucio Fulci would make a dance movie, and so then I started researching it, and apparently one of his producers was like, Flashdance is doing well, you're going to make a Flashdance horror movie. And he did, and it's set in New York City, and it's about all these dancers competing to get on a TV show, and they start killing each other.
Wow.
And it's all of these dance sequences, and it's the most confusing. I can't say it's good. Uh-huh. I will say it's kind of amazing to watch.
Yeah. Now, Ryan, you mentioned the poster. Are you a Murderock guy? ever since our Spectrovision episode where you were like, guys come into my office and like, I like horror, but I'm not a Prowler guy.
Are you
a Murderock?
I'm a Murderock guy.
Would you put a Murderock poster
up? I totally would. It's a great poster.
Honestly, I think I would hang up a Murderock poster.
I think shout out to Dennis Widmeyer because he's a big Murderock fan.
Is he really?
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
I've seen him Facebook post a couple times about it.
You can tell a lot about a person by whether or not they like Murder Rock.
What kind of Fulci fan are you? Are you a Murder Rock guy?
I'm a Murder Rock guy.
That makes like Beyond all the way, whatever.
Yeah. No, I have to say, I mean, again, I can't say it's a great movie. It's not the best Fulci I've ever seen, but it's something, and it's definitely worth watching.
It's one of those guys made films in every genre. He's made comedies. Like, I would never want to watch a Fulci comedy, ever. Right. Like, I don't think you could force me to watch a Fulci comic. That sounds horrible to me.
The dance sequences.
Isn't that House by the Cemetery?
Yeah, I love that film. I love that.
I got to say, the dance sequences, as far as like 80s dance movies go, they're not bad. I mean, like, they're not like Aerobicide level. Have you guys seen Aerobicide?
Yeah. No,
that one's pretty rough. Despa. yeah, so they're not horrible, but that's the dance perspective. And then the one that was the highlight of my week is not available in the U.S., so you guys are going to have to pick up a regionalist for this one. It is, where did it go? I just handed
it. I have it right here.
Oh, Rob has it. Is a Thai movie from 2008 called Coming Soon. And I found this because a couple of weeks ago I posted like 10 international horror films you probably missed on Blumhouse.com, and somebody tweeted at me, hey, have you seen this? And I hadn't seen it, and then I went on Amazon and couldn't find it because it hadn't been released in the States. So I ended up buying it off eBay, and it's the Thai edition. Thank God it has English subtitles. The whole movie is about a group of people who work at this theater, and it's a multiplex. It's like a major, major movie theater, and this movie is releasing, and one of the guys decides to pirate it before it gets released to the public. So he starts watching it and recording it and everything, and some type of ghost gets released. and it starts killing off everybody in the theater, all of the other employees. But this is like a major film that is supposed to release to the entire nation. So then they start trying to figure out what the ghost is, if there is actually a ghost. Does it exist? Why is it there? What's going to happen when everybody sees it? So the plot is pretty cool to begin with. You think it's going to be kind of midnight movie-like, and it's completely, it turns out completely different. Like, there's a lot of twists to it. But that said, it is probably the scariest movie I've seen in years.
Wow.
Like, the whole time, I was just like, this is fucking intense. Like, it is a scary movie. So I highly recommend checking it out. And if anybody else has seen it, please tweet at me because I don't have anybody to talk about this movie with.
Well, hopefully by next week.
Yeah.
We'll see.
It's great.
I think Rebecca is on a buoy in the middle of the ocean. That buoy is represented by coming soon.
And the
fact
shark
that, and the
is,
shark is the fact that no one has seen this
no
movie.
No one has seen this movie. And this
that
seagull.
Ass. Anyway, that'll be my meme. I'll just leave that ass.
And the seagull is represented. I don't know where this is going now.
Oh, boy. It's going to get weird.
And the crabs are.
It's getting weird, guys.
Anyway, so definitely try to seek out Coming Soon. I really enjoyed this one.
Cool.
It's definitely got some kind of, I'll say, cultural differences to it. Like the slit-mouthed woman definitely plays into that, which is definitely part of more of an Asian mythology. But yeah,
I like
it's
that.
Still, it's a really cool concept.
Cool. What about you, Alric?
You know what? I came on TV and I couldn't not watch. It was Death Wish 1 and 2 were playing. But the thing, about, I hadn't seen Death Wish in forever. I'd seen sequels in the last few years. Death Wish in maybe like 20 years. And that film really surprised me how strong a performance it is.
Yeah.
And also, I'd always been relegated to like, because of the sequels, it's been relegated to being an exploitation film. Mm. But it really isn't. It's actually a lot more in common with a Taxi Driver than it does pure exploitation. It's not quite at that level, but it's not that far off because the actual opening is disturbing. It's one of the truly most horrifying like rapes. I always thought it was kind of funny and stupid, like from memory, like just because they're punks. But it's actually pretty horrifying. And then
Jeff Goldblum being one
Jeff
of those
Goldblum,
punks.
But then his growth into vigilante is so it's so subtle, the pacing of the story, and then the last act is not great. Like the last act where it becomes a procedural, you don't really care anymore. Once it takes the shift away from him. But then number two came on and I was like, oh fuck, Michael Winner actually is a good director. Like people think of him as a joke. You watch number two and it's like fat, like the way he puts these, it's not a very good, that movie's pretty unlikable.
That's
pretty,
more unexplained.
That's definitely, I mean, the rape scenes and the sexuality is like really kind of
horrific.
Yeah, it feels almost, it feels real bad. Yeah,
right.
Bad,
you know what I feel
it.
Like it's like it's kind of like the misconception with Rambo, like people think Rambo but don't remember that First Blood is nothing like those sequels.
Exactly.
You just have the same thing with Death Wish. You think of Charlie Bronson, but that first movie's really,
it's a
really
real performance
great.
He's growing into this thing. He doesn't really want to be. The first time he goes out, the empowerment of holding a gun, I just thought it was, I was really surprised by it, and it was a
one
nice,
of my favorite
nice
final
feeling.
Shots too.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah, when he jokes with the guy in the
so
airport
great.
Yeah, it's good. So that was just a random one, but a couple that I hunted down. So, okay, might be my movie of the year, but it's not, this will kind of surprise people, it's only kind of got a little bit of a horror streak. It's the film Demon, we were talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
Marcin Rona, you know, a lot of people by now have heard the sad part of the story, which is, you know, his film premiered at a Polish film festival, great reviews, and then a week, then he was found dead by hanging in his hotel room straight away. So he never really got the saddest thing about this film, because I knew it would be up my alley. I had to drive an hour to get to the only cinema that was playing it, so I was pretty committed. But I'm a big Polish cinema fan, just like you're a big South Korean cinema fan, and I'd heard good things about it, so I was like, okay, it's probably a safe bet. It is so well directed that it's, I mean, that's the thing that you walk away more than the movie itself, is how well put together. It's orchestrated, as in there'll be characters in the foreground who are going through a possession story, but in the background, it's all set, the entire film, against this wedding in real time. So there's guests and hundreds of people laughing and making you laugh and really surreal. It becomes, if anyone's familiar with Buñuel films, which are like kind of funny, but like weird, surreal comedy, it's a mixture of that and Polanski. Polanski at his best when he can mix humor with really tense, actually scared, like Rosemary's Baby has that balance of some characters who are over the top and funny.
Yeah.
This film hit all my sweet spots. It was almost funny to me. Like I'm sitting there going, oh wow, it's like the guy made you a movie, you know? But it's also pretty ambiguous with the horror. It's a Dybbuk story. So in Poland's history, do you know the comic book Mouse? Very famous comic book that was really dealing with Poland's responsibility to the death of the Jews in World War II, that there was a lot of Jewish people in Poland and they kind of gave them up to kind of save their own asses. And it's cast a big shadow over Poland all these years. And they kind of feel, you know, they feel there's a lot of remorse and a lot of guilt. So this movie is literally about that, but done through a possession story. A groom at the wedding shows up. He's excited to get married. He
finds a body in the backyard, and from that moment on, he starts slowly getting possessed throughout the wedding, and no one knows what the hell's happening, but this one guy goes, oh, it's a Dybbuk, and they're like, what do you mean? It's like, well, it's a Dybbuk, which is actually, in the Jewish mythology, another word is cling, and it means that something that clings to something that's living and basically slowly takes them over. So there is it's definitely a horror movie, but it's when I recommend a movie like this, it's like with that caveat, this is definitely more in the world of an art house, like a really great movie, but it has horror themes, but it might not be satisfying to that quick car. You know, someone just looking for that, oh, that'll be a fun movie to go see.
Sure.
But man, is it well put together, and there's a lot going on. And it's an actual tragedy. It's not just saying that, like, to lose a director like that, you're like, Jesus. But looking at it through that lens, you go, okay, it's dealing with a lot of themes that you could see could come through depression, guilt, whatever the person could have been going through. I don't know why he did it, of course. Great film. So if that comes out.
Wow. Where did you find it?
That was playing at the New Art for a week. And it might still be, it might get another week. But so it's probably a Lemley. So if you live somewhere where there's Lemleys, you might get to see it.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's got like a 92 on
Rotten
Tomatoes.
Is it worth the drive to, wait, that's in Santa Monica, right?
It's near that. I mean, I did it just because I had heard, I could tell it was going to be my kind of thing, but it was nice too. It's also just really funny. The characters are funny, but then in the central thing, the horror is not funny. Like those moments are like, oh, and that's what, there haven't been a lot of directors who are able to find that balance. And it might be a foreign thing, you know, like some people's tones. And the other thing I'd been looking for years. So the cool thing about being at the New Art, if you're from LA, is it has the greatest video store on earth right next to it.
Yes.
And it's been a couple years. I used to live in West Hollywood. It's been a couple years since I lived near this place. So I was like, okay, I'm going to rent something. The film.
What's it called?
Cinephile.
Cinephile.
Mm-hmm. Great video store. One of my favorite movies, as everyone knows who listens to this, a film I get a kick out, is The Kindred. It's a really funny, crazy movie. Like, so good. I had never seen The Power. It's one I could never find, and it was the film they made between The Dorm That Dripped Blood and The Kindred. It's their middle film. And I've seen the trailer, and it looked really cool. It looked like it's about like a little, you know, kind of little talisman thing that gives you this power, and you slowly become almost like a demon, but you have these ridiculous powers of grandeur. So the team is Stephen Carpenter and Jeffrey Obrow. They're a producer, writer, director team. I think they teach at UCLA now. Anyway, this film, I've always found The Dorm That Dripped Blood a little clunky. This film is somewhere in between. It's like got a couple of those, you know, the thing about Kindred is the goopy effects, and those moments are so fucking great. Yeah. This has like one dream scene that is so great.
Because I've seen like the Power with George Hamilton, and I assume this is not the one.
Whatever
that you're
Kindred
about.
Is, it's like three. Okay. It's an 80s film or lately, an early 80s. It's not, I don't think it's that easy to find. That's why I hadn't seen it. But this store has everything, and it's a proper copy of it. It's a lot of fun, but the start and end are great, but the middle it's, you know, those painful plotting movies where it's like you start with teenagers and you're like, oh, cool, they're good characters. And then you introduce a couple adults, and then you're with the adults for the middle. And then the teenagers come back in the last 10 minutes. You're like, I like the teen film.
1984.
And that is a great poster. I just pulled
it's
up.
Really trippy.
That's a really cool poster.
And The Kindred's 86 then. Anyway, I think it's fun. But, you know, if you can, just skip right to The Kindred. And then the last thing that put me to sleep, so I'm not going to talk about it for long, I also rented, and I'd be curious to know if Ryan's seen this, or it was this Argento TV series called Doors to Darkness. That was 73. So it was right after his first three movies. And it was like he produced all four of them. They're 4 1-hour episodes. They're kind of like Hitchcock Presents. Yeah, yeah. They're not horror. I found them deathly boring, and I was really excited about them.
When I was first introduced to Argento, I sought them out, and then those just kind of got lost to memory, you know.
That's how I felt. I watched the first two, and I was like, you know what? He didn't direct them all. He directed the middle one, and they're all other Italian. It fit more in that police drama, procedural. I just found, you know what? It was that thing where, because it's made for TV, they'll linger on a shot like me grabbing the coffee right now. They'll linger for like 10 seconds longer than you want that shot to be. And I just started thinking, is this a 20-minute film that has to be an hour?
Right, probably.
Anyway, so that is missable for you completists, which I was trying to be, but pass.
All righty. What about you, Ron? See anything this week?
I saw a lot.
Oh, boy.
I took in a lot. I took a little me time this weekend.
All
and
right.
I kept my Mummy series going. So as you listened last week, you know, I rewatched Mummy and didn't like it. I took another one for the team, and it's The Mummy's Hand, the follow-up. And my God, they just get worse. This one, they recycle footage from The Mummy and tell a new Mummy story, kind of backstory. But they focus on these two kind of Americans who are in Egypt and they're looking for a way to get back, but they don't have the money. So they're just kind of like well-dressed goofballs just moseying about, and they come upon an urn, and said urn can direct them to another archaeological site where there's a another mummy. And they have like this kind of one guy they take the urn to, and he's like, oh, this is just bullshit. It's fake. And then they're like, well, we'll take it to somebody else. And he's like, whoops, I dropped it. And he knew what the secret was. You know, he knew what they were talking about. And he was just looking for that one final piece, which was on the urn, to direct him where to go to find this mummy. Anyways, it was weird because it was funny that Universal took on, they kind of countered the dread and the slow burn nature of the mummy and just injected humor into it. So with the mummy, they were like, well, if the kids didn't like that, maybe we'll just add these two buffoons who kind of have an Abbott and Costello type vibe to them. But I kept dozing off. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is, they're tough.
Some of
they're
them are tough. Yeah.
They're really tough. So that was The Mummy's Hand. I followed that with Cat's Eye, which I hadn't seen in quite a while. And Cat's Eye still holds up as a great, like, just great storytelling.
Quitter's Ink.
Quitter's Ink and the Ledge.
Yeah. Oh, Quitter's Ink was amazing.
Quitter and James Woods is so good in it. There's this great moment, because if you guys don't know, Quitter's Ink is about, you know, James Woods, who's trying to kick smoking. He goes to the eponymous company to help, and I think it's Alan King who's trying to help him get rid of smoking, but they have a very unorthodox ways of doing it. And no matter where he goes, you know, he knows he's being watched. But there's this great moment where he's on a highway and they're waiting for this drawbridge to go down. And he's looking around and he opens up his glove box and a pack of cigarettes fall out. And he kind of does this look. He's like looking at the guy in the convertible, looking in the car in front of him. It's just a pack full of kids. He's looking at the truck behind him. Looks okay. And then he's like, and he kind of ducks out of sight and he's like getting a cigarette ready. But the look James Woods gives is so fucking awesome that I was just dying. I had to rewatch it because he's just like, I'm going to get away with this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really, really good. And The Ledge really holds up really
well,
too.
That's my favorite story. Mm-hmm. And the bad guy's performance in that is amazing.
So good. And You know what's funny is, like, yes, a lot of the street stuff is done with miniatures, but they're convincing.
Yeah.
Like, they really work, you know? I mean, like, it was obviously done on a stage and, you know, they used the city back, like, kind of a little city backdrop and little toy cars and stuff like that, but it really works and it really sells. Like, my hands still got, like, kind of sweaty because of the dread.
It's the Star of Airplane, right?
Yeah, the Star of Airplane. Oh, yeah, exactly. Wow. Yeah.
Who has a drinking problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. But it's so funny because I had introduced it to my girlfriend and she's like, wait a minute. So the cat takes us from story to story. And I'm like, yes. And then I realized that the cat goes by train, boat. And then I forgot the other means of which he gets to his location. But it's like, this cat's worldly. Like, he's just. And the funny thing is he goes.
Fighting gremlins.
Fighting gremlins. But the funny thing is he goes from New York. And then he gets on a boat and then he's in Vegas. And I'm like, hold up, cat. How did you get on a boat and get to Vegas?
And Louis Teague did that, right?
Louis Teague. Because he does a little nod to Cujo at the beginning, Christine.
See, my memory of the problem, I saw it maybe last year, the problem I had with it, not problem because I enjoyed it, but it's so, the tone is so weird between the stories that if you had kids, that last story would be a great introduction to horror.
Yeah.
But if they watched the James Wood one, there's literally a line where they say, we will rape your wife.
Yep. Oh, yes.
And so like, you're like, oh my God, who is this aimed
in
for?
In a joking way.
Yeah, in a joking way. Like black, it's really dark.
Humor, yes.
But then the last one's a really kid friendly and kind of a fun gateway horror.
Yeah, that's the one I haven't seen it in years, but I remember the Drew Barrymore little troll gremlin thing with the cat. That's the only memory I have. However, the Blu-ray of this, Salem's Lot and Stephen King's It comes out on Tuesday, the 20th.
Yeah.
However, if somebody out there can tell me, they're not on Amazon, so I'm not sure
if they
are like Best Buy exclusives or you can only get them through Warner's Direct.
Right.
But they are coming out next weekend, and I'm looking forward to picking them all up.
Salem's Lot. Yeah. Can't wait to get that.
It's crazy. Yeah. And the stuff that they get away with, you know, in terms of animal performances in this movie, it's remarkable. Like, obviously, this was mid-80s, so they can get away with whatever they want. But the cat is amazing. Like, the cat as an actor is hands down amazing.
But Ryan,
like, best cat actor.
If you can direct an alligator, you can direct a fucking cat. Louis Teague cut his chops on a fucking alligator.
Yeah, but he did. I mean, but it's great. And there's like a great moment in The Ledge where there's like a pigeon, but the pigeon's always hitting his mark. And it's like, oh my God, this pigeon's great. So Cat's Eye, although, you know, out of the trio, the troll one is the least.
It ages,
you know,
the worst. Yeah. But I bet if you're a kid, it would probably be really cool. You know?
Yeah. I mean, like, you can get into, like, you know, watching Drew Barrymore do her thing. The funny thing is they utilize Drew Barrymore in Quitters Inc. in the worst possible way. They give her these Coke bottle glasses and a stupid haircut. And she's like, daddy. And it's like, what's going on? Like, I don't know. It's like, I didn't want to be mean about it and make fun of her, but it's just like, she's only there for like 2 minutes and it's terrible. And then what else did I see? I saw Mummy's Hand, Cat's Eye, and then I watched House on Sorority Row. Oh. I haven't seen that in ages. And it is one of my favorite slashers. I love that movie.
I got to see that.
Really?
I
got to see it too. I haven't seen it in years.
It is so good.
Is it on Blu-ray?
Somebody put it on Blu-ray.
Wow. Somebody put it on Blu-ray. It's available on like almost every VOD, like whatever deal, like whoever handles the rights for it. It's on every VOD platform. And it's a solid, solid slasher. Great setup. Great cast of characters. Great stakes. Like the stakes are always amplifying. There's always something that might put these girls at risk of being found out for what they did. And the mystery is always good. And then it gets super wacky, batshit nuts at the end. And even the lighting shifts and all this other stuff.
Did you like the remake? Sorority Row.
I love the remake, the 2009
it's
remake.
So,
I think it's fun.
So trashy.
Yeah, you did, Ben.
Yeah,
so
it's fun and sleazy. And I think it's great.
Yeah. I have to revisit it. I saw it. I saw it when I was press, and I couldn't get into it. But this one, what's interesting about this one is that it's like an hour and 40 minutes long, but it doesn't feel, it feels incredibly tight, incredibly short. It feels like it's always moving. I don't know. I mean, like in terms of, you know, kind of like the slasher era, you know, this one doesn't, I feel like this one doesn't get brought up enough. And even the killer is pretty cool too. So, I mean, like,
and I love that period because they would be like pretty straight ahead slashers, but like Happy Birthday to Me and that, the ones that then end in a batshit way where you're like, oh, that elevates it just above.
Right.
All the remakes always go for a very generic, straight, realist endings.
Exactly.
There's something pretty interesting in those
80s. Yeah. Yeah. No, but it was just, it's a cool, and it also kind of gives you a sense of the kind of college camaraderie, you know, like they keep it over the course of, you know, when things start going nuts, they keep it over the course of a night at this party, you know, and you definitely kind of get that teenage vibe that you got from films like My Bloody Valentine that made you love the characters even more. And then all, you know, every stereotype is represented. There's the bitch, there's the good girl, there's, you know, there's the drunk. But it's fun. It's really fun. And then
Scorpio releasing maybe did that?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And then finally I watched Cast a Deadly Spell. Which was on HBO Go, and I hadn't seen that since it was on VHS. And honestly, I commend their effort to really embrace noir and then just throw Lovecraft all over it. But
Is this the Dennis Hopper one?
No, that's Witch Hunt. Fred Ward.
Okay, so is that the which one came first?
Cast a Deadly Spell. Okay, it's Fred Ward and Julianne Moore.
I haven't seen either of them. I want to see them.
Witch Hunt's not so good. Cast a Deadly Spell, it's fascinating and interesting. I definitely think it's worth checking out.
Yeah,
Ryan doesn't seem to like it.
I know. I remember you talking about it, and that's what prompted me to like go on HBO Go and go, all right, let's finally rewatch this. And it's just got pacing issues. It's just got storytelling issues because it's just like, okay, come on, let's go to the next thing. And every time they did something clever where it was like noir and Lovecraft coming together, I was like, okay, now I'm back in. And then I was like, oh, nope, now we're going back into the noir procedural elements of it, and it's not well written and it's not being handled properly, so I'm kind of out. But David Warner's great in it, and Julianne Moore.
Were they made for
smoking
TV?
Hot. Julianne
Moore. They were
TV
made
movie.
For
was HBO.
Cinema. Yeah,
okay.
HBO.
Yeah. Huh. But there was a period when HBO was doing all these kind of like original, like Full Eclipse, Cast a Deadly Spell,
Nightflyer.
Yeah.
Or is that
Nightflyer?
No,
was
that
was
an independent. Was it HBO? Oh, the HBO did come in on it at some point.
They
but it
did,
wasn't independently made.
They ended up playing it all the time.
And they sold it to them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yep. I've got two quick things. First is a movie that just came out, I think, at the last weekend called Night of the Living Deb on Blu-ray. And I saw the trailer. I mean, the honest truth is I didn't really like it. I didn't think it worked. But I wanted to bring it up as a follow-up to a lot of what we discussed last week when we had Jordan Peele on the show, where this was definitely a comedy horror, where the comedy was intended to be the main element. And just kind of the horror conceit is the whole zombie thing. And nowadays it's really hard to pull it off. Like when Ryan and I were talking a few weeks ago, it's like we've seen so many zombie movies, but you see something like Train to Busan, the Korean
Train to Busan,
one,
yeah.
And you're like, oh, all right, that's a neat, unique angle to it.
Yeah.
This one is not, you know, it's and it's actually not very funny. But you know,
it felt like, what was the
other
movie?
Did you see this one or no?
No, I saw the trailer for it. And then what was the other one with, it was another play on words where it was like the girlfriend comes back from the dead.
Oh, Burying the Ex.
Burying the Ex.
Not Burying. It was like the flip side. It was another one. Higher cast. John C. Reilly. What's
oh,
her face?
God.
From,
I know who you're talking about. And, yeah. And I couldn't get through that movie.
If,
yeah.
If only we had a device in our hands.
I know.
That
I know,
we're all
I know,
holding yeah. right this second. I'll look it up, guys.
But, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. If check out the trailer. Because the reason I bring it up, because I know a lot of our listeners do like that kind of horror comedy stuff or might be looking for something kind of light and fun over the Halloween season. So if you're looking for something that's more, not as horror, but more kind of a comedy, this might be up your alley. But I really had a tough time. I didn't really find it that funny. The saving grace is Ray Wise, who appears as the father, because first of all, Ray's in everything. And
playing,
second of all,
playing a father.
But he's, you know, but he's so
spoiler,
good.
Ryan, spoiler. Even just using that word in his name's a spoiler.
But he's great in everything. So when he showed up, I actually had a few chuckles because yeah. he's just, that's what Ray's best at.
Right.
Life After Bath.
That's Life After Beth, which was a chore.
Yeah, I did
huge
not
chore.
Enjoy that
I do
one.
Like the other one, Warm Bodies, which was also
it was
a line
very charming.
Words.
Yeah,
so
it was
that
very
one
sweet.
I dug. And last but not least, there's a little disc sitting in front of Ryan right there that might have the first couple of episodes of Ash vs. Evil Dead Season 2,
yeah.
which I checked out last night. So I'm here to give you the advance word. If you like the first season, you're going to love this because it's pretty much in line with what they set up. It's really good. It's really, really good. The reason I'm not going out of my way to be like, oh, it's great, is because you set the bar really high by having Sam Raimi do the first episode of the first season. And again, I don't think they've ever reached that bar again from that first pilot episode because you know, they got, you know, decent enough directors. The first season was pretty fun for the first few episodes. And then in the middle kind of lingers. And then the last two or three are strong again. And at least with the first two here, it starts out pretty strong. It's really, really funny. It's really gory as hell. More so than I actually think, you know, in the first season, they kind of use CGI to enhance some of the gore stuff. Mm. I only spotted in those two episodes maybe one shot of CG. Mm. They like really go for it and pour lots of blood okay. all over the place. And a lot of it's practical and looks really great. Everybody's back. Lee Majors is Ash's dad, which is really funny. And he goes back to his hometown because at the end of the last season, and this isn't much of a spoiler, but you know, there's supposedly a truce between the Deadites and Ash. They're going to leave each other alone.
What?
They're going to go do their evil and whatever. And the truce is immediately broken. He's trying to enjoy life and be a party animal in Jacksonville, Florida, which for whatever reason, Ash thinks is the greatest place on earth. So the Deadites are back and he's trying to figure out like why they broke the truce. And he decides to go back home. And it's pretty funny because now we get to see, you know, the aftermath of the Evil Dead movies is that, like, you know, spray painted on his front door of his old house is Ashy Slashy. So, like, everyone makes fun of him because the rumor is he went and murdered all his friends and chopped them up. And he's like, you know, I can't remember one of the gags, but one of them is like, he's like, oh, I knew exactly what I was doing. When I chopped up all my friends and tried taking that, you know. But it's really funny that I was telling Ryan before we came in here. There is a moment in the second episode that is so over the top, and it's probably the greatest Evil Dead moment of the entire franchise. Because I was watching it with two or three friends, and like we were like crying, laughing so loud, and like holding each other because it was so freaking ridiculous. Yeah. What happens? But yeah, they're off to a good start.
I have a question for
yes.
you. Yes. Do we need Ash's dad?
No.
Do we need to see Ash's dad?
No, not at all.
Do we need to get into the familial roots of Ash?
No, the only, you know, and that's, you know, certain, here's the funny thing. It's like, and I'm glad you bring this point up. There's certain elements about the show, you know, because obviously the first season, you're trying to figure out how do we get back into this world? We have new characters, we have new storylines. What, you know, what do we do? Where, you know, for the second season, No, but they're leading up to Cheryl, his sister.
Oh, right.
And I think that's reason enough, you know? Yeah. I also feel weird about the supporting cast. Like, I really like the girl and, you know, Pablo and the girl. I don't know if they're as prominent. Like, you know, she's kind of just foul-mouthed and screaming obscenities, which is kind of funny.
Right.
But they're kind of secondary. The reason the show is so strong is because, you know, Bruce is Ash. Yeah. And I mean, like, I did an article on all the one-liners for the entire first season, and he does more in the first two episodes than the entire first season. Like, he's just on top of it. And I think the reason we watch is because we want those radical Evil Dead moments. And not to spoil it, but, like, one example is, you know, he's in a dark room, and he looks over at his shadow, and he thinks his shadow moved. So right, it's kind of like, wait, is, you know, it's saying, you know, there's a new version of... of kind of like the little tricks that the Deadites play on him.
Right, right.
And that's where a lot of the comedy comes in, is obviously he's like, I got you. So I think it's going to be a fun season. And I'm so happy it exists.
Yeah,
that's the main thing.
Exactly. It's like you could be really hard on it. I mean, like, the thing is that the show has a difficult balance to strike, which is fan servicing and then doing stuff new and continually pushing it forward. So I was a little hesitant once they, you know, wrapped up season one and they were getting into season two and they started shooting and they were like, so-and-so is Ash's dad. I'm like, I don't know if I need to go there. But if Lee Majors delivers, then I'm completely on board, you know. But it's kind of like you need to kind of go down these narrative routes to kind of keep the show going. Like,
well, because
fresh,
you've got two of the three movies are set in the cabin in the woods. And this is a show outside of that scene. So it's hard to keep it, you know, where do you go?
But I do like that they keep tying it back. And they, they do fun. I was telling Elric before, they do fun gags from the first season that you think are just going to be repeat gags, but then they do them in a way that's like, oh, okay, I gotcha.
Right, right.
And then in terms of fan service, they keep... like, it's funny where they keep finding pockets in the three movies to go back to. For example, you know, Cheryl is hinted at. So I feel like that's going to be an element.
You think they'll bring back some of the original players?
I already know for that one for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm excited.
Only because she said it on her Facebook, I think.
Oh, okay.
You know, so that's
where you're not saying who it is, so that's fine.
Yeah. And, you know, Ted Raimi hasn't popped up yet. He's supposed to be his childhood best friend at some point this season.
Oh, cool.
He's always
I can see. I'd rather be the two of them and cut the other character.
It'd be amazing if it was Ted Raimi from Darkman.
And Bruce from Darkman.
It would be. So that's the latest. We're gonna
Ted Raimi from Hard Target at the beginning of Hard Target. He's like, come on, man.
Anyone I'm gonna do one more plug before we head into the interview, which I completely forgot about. So I had Shudder back when it first launched, like a year ago, and got like a free week and absolutely loved it, but then didn't sign up. And then this past week, I was really trying to hunt down this British film called Exam that I wanted to see.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw that it was streaming through my Amazon Prime, but only if you had the Shudder. And I was like, hey, it's $5 a month, so I'll do it. I've been watching Shudder nonstop. Like Exam, there was one on there, a Spanish film called Ferment's Room that I hadn't seen yet. Mm. Really good.
Yeah.
The coolest thing about it is the how they get somebody like Nacho Vigalondo or somebody who will be pick their films that they like from the Shudder category, and it has that nice curated vibe, which I think is fun.
Yeah,
I like that there's things on there that I haven't seen before, because that was when, and though I love the people who programmed it, when I first got my like trial of it a year ago, I was going through and I was like, I've seen every single one of these, but I mean, it's still great.
But they've had time to grow their library.
It's all deal making. Yeah.
And so now when I'm going through, I'm like, I haven't seen a lot of these. This is awesome. So I really recommend checking it out. It's only like $5 a month now through my Amazon. Amazon Prime. Yeah.
Oh, through Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. Right. I'm going to see if I can get it that way then.
Yeah.
Because that was the thing, is that it wouldn't, I didn't know how to get it through, you know, I watch everything through a Sony device, so practically like a PlayStation, and it's not available that way, but I do have Amazon Prime on it.
So yeah, I have Amazon, so it just goes right through that, and it just goes on like my regular Amazon account. Right.
Okay, cool.
Exam was actually really good. It's got Pollyanna McIntosh.
Oh, yeah, I want to see that one. Yeah, I know what you're talking about now.
Yeah, it's got like the ending feels a little bit like it ends, and then it's got like a second ending that you're like, you could have just ended at the first one. But aside from that, it was like a really fascinating film throughout.
I wonder if Shudder has the Wolf Creek movies in Rogue.
I don't know. We should check. That was really a great tie-in there,
really
Elric.
Really quick before your tie-in.
Oh, now
so tonight. So tonight is the debut of American Horror Story.
Yes.
Season 6.
2 days ago.
So let's go around the table. I want to hear what your potential theme, what the theme could be for this season.
Because like by the time this hits, ones.
We could be completely way off.
Wrong. Okay.
Completely wrong.
Because they released a whole bunch of, they released like five different teasers. And then they were like, okay, only one of them's real. I'm going with the kind of homespun one that they released where it was like a farmhouse surrounded by fields. I think that it's going to be something kind of like twisted in like a Heartland horror.
Interesting.
I have no idea because I don't watch the show.
Rob don't give a shit.
He watched the first season.
Rob's all Ash versus Evil Dead.
The second part of this question is it going to work for them and be a ratings? Like, is that going to burst it through the roof because everyone's curious, or are people going to be confused?
I think it'll burst through the roof anyway because it's American Horror Story and it always
does. I'm curious. I think it's going to be a cult storyline. I feel like, and it might be what you're talking about, but with some sort of a version of a cult. I don't know why. I just started to think, I think that's a world that could be interesting. So
I did like one of the teasers.
I think it's going to be about pizza.
No, go get the pizza.
Okay, the pizza. Yeah, one of the teasers that they did release for it had a lot of nuances, or it may have been an Instagram photo, but it hinted at the Roanoke colony, which I think would be a really cool way to go with it. So I'm hoping that that plays in somewhere and that that wasn't just like a false lead.
Well, I'm still wondering if Shudder would play Wolf Creek movie.
That's a good idea. I'm going to wonder that over this
or
slice
Rogue.
Of pizza.
Or
Rogue.
We're going to have a little bit of pizza, and we'll be back with a bit of a city slicker. All right. See you next time.
All right, and we're back, and we have a very, very, very special guest sitting with us, something that we want to have on the show pretty much since we started. Welcome, Mr. Greg McLean.
Thank you very much. Oh, great to be here. Great to be back.
Yeah.
That's right. Many great meetings in this conference room.
There we go. Yeah. I mean, Ryan, why don't you talk a little bit about your relationship with Greg since you are in-house here at Blumhouse.
Well, yeah. Well, when I came in, you were in post on The Darkness. So, you know, I saw and I would love to talk, and Cooper actually brought this up, talk about the ending of The Darkness, which is now available on Blu-ray and the – you can find the ending, the original ending on the Blu-ray. But first off, I just want to say congratulations on the Belko experiment.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And the TIFF date. We've been hearing a lot about that one.
Amazing hype on that one.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I don't know if this is necessarily the forum to start promoting just yet because it's amazing. And we're going to lead up to the March 17th release through BH Till. But I just have to say congratulations. It's an insane, insane, ultra-violent,
listen,
gleefully ultra-violent movie.
All right. I've got my questions, but we're going to get to that eventually. Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, you know, look, the way we start the show with most filmmakers we have on is, I mean, I don't know much about your humble beginnings in the filmmaking world, but, you know, for all of us, we started out getting into horror at a very impressionable age. It's the one genre that I think definitely hits you a certain way. So for you, I mean, when did you first kind of get a love of horror movies?
When I was growing up, my mom actually had interesting tastes in movies. She used to be up late ironing and doing stuff. And for some reason, she would always be watching Alfred Hitchcock movies, which I would watch and sort of understand that there was a really dark subtext to those films. There was something else going on in those movies, which I now realize was this, you know, all this kind of crazy, depressed stuff going on in Hitchcock's life that's in his movies. And when you see that as a kid, it's like going, there's something behind all this. I'm not quite sure. I don't understand what it is. Besides the fact that they're the great, you know, some of the greatest movies of all time, there's a sort of darker, you know, idea behind them. So I remember seeing those movies and then seeing Hammer Horror. A lot of Hammer Horror films were on television in Australia at that time. So seeing those films at a young age and going, what the hell is this? Those kind of things were the things that I remember that kind of in way back just kind of, I mean, who knows how you really get inspired by things, but I was from a young age just very drawn to that kind of stuff. And I was always into ghosts and UFOs and monsters and things. And then my interest just naturally kind of grew from there.
Mm-hmm. But were you scared of this stuff initially and kind of trying to face that fear, or did you just, you know, embrace it full on?
I think it was more just fascination, just fascination with, you know, I don't know, just fascination with this other world. There's another world. Everything sort of seemed to suggest that there was something else other than the world that we live in. And it was just around the corner. And if you basically looked hard enough or lucky enough, you'd actually see one of these things one day. And as a kid, my entire childhood was spent, I had a ghost hunting club with my sister and my best friend. And we would basically go to, I had a book in primary school. I found this fantastic book. It was, you know, ghost hunting. And and it was we would go to old houses. We lived in the country. we'd get in our bikes. It was kind of like Stranger Things, like childhood. We'd live in a country town. We'd find an old farmhouse and we'd go there and we'd explore it and we'd set up traps and put powder on the floor and put cotton across and try and do all these things to see if there's any ghosts in the house. And we really believed it, and we really had a great child. It was a very cool place to grow up, because it was just like a big, we used to live in a big farmhouse and there was like 20 kids in my primary school, and we could just ride around our bikes and do cool shit like that. But it was all, it was always to do with kind of crazy adventures we'd sort of go on and trying to discover the monsters who just lived over the hill, or the crazy people lived in the farmhouse that was down the end of the forest kind of thing. And I don't know, there was just always something curious about that.
Greg McLean, Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, that's right. You meddling kids.
So what was the when you were taking in these Hammer horror films and the kind of earlier horror films from the heyday, were you just watching them as a fan, or was the inner filmmaker, the little filmmaker, quietly kind of starting to pick things apart? And if not, what was the film where you actually looked at a horror film and said, okay, that's something that I'm going to start analyzing, like filmmaking?
Early on, it was just impressions of things. Yeah. And, with that is also movies that were Australian movies, like, when I was young and saw the first Mad Max movie.
Yeah.
There's a very sort of dark subtext to that film. And when you're young and you see that image of that highway and you see those people getting attacked by that terribly scary gang, it's really it's a very strong sense of this dangerous kind of place out there. Those kind of things, I guess looking at things like Mad Max, basically, sort of think, well, I know this film was made an hour away by these people and they made it for like $300,000, so that sounds like it's something possible. But then I think other horror films that kind of inspired me to actually think about it were, moving on from there, I was kind of, the films that really sort of shaped me were the first Evil Dead movie, first Texas Chainsaw movie, Alien, Jaws, those kind of films, where you start to see kind of the sophistication and the storytelling, and you start to see the, with films like that in particular, you start to sense a kind of very primary, almost mythic concept at the heart of those really great horror films.
Right.
And you realize that, when you pull a little back and start to wonder why these particular things are so powerful and how do they generate such an incredibly powerful emotional response, you just realize there's a real mythic power to certain concepts. Then you start reading Stephen King and you start reading Danse Macabre and you start unpacking the whole thing and looking at the mythic basis of all horror and scary stories as a kind of thing that goes way back to when we first started telling stories in the first place. And you just kind of get this perspective on it, and it becomes more and more fascinating. I forgot the question.
That totally answers it. Yeah.
Well, when you were growing up, how did you see a lot of these impressionable movies? Tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you'd get access to this stuff. Did you have anyone in your family that was very movie savvy and took you to see Alien and things like that?
Not really, but actually, the story of how I experienced Alien is really interesting because I lived on a big farmhouse in the middle of nowhere, a big open, like it was a kind of spooky old house. And so it was kind of ripe for my brothers and sisters to play pranks and to be and be a bit mischievous. So we're always, our mission in our childhood was to scare the living shit out of each other, basically. We also had an outside toilet. So you can imagine a big old farmhouse in the middle of it on a hill surrounded by some what do you call dams here in America? Like water dams? Like what do you call those? Like
dams.
Dams.
Yeah. So we had these different dams in different parts of the forest around the house. And then you had all these mischievous kids who were bored kind of coming up with crazy things to do, how to scare each other. And so the journey from the house at night to the bathroom was always a particularly terrifying one, because inevitably there would be three or four kids hanging out there ready to jump out and scare the hell out of you as you were sitting there trying to do your stuff.
You mean the dunny, right?
The dunny.
Yeah. Let's be specific for our Australian listeners.
The thunderbox.
Yeah, then.
So that was kind of it was a fairly fun and active kind of environment, in the sense of like it was very outdoorsy and very fun, but it was all based around this big old house we lived in, which was surrounded by farm sheds, and it was kind of creepy. It was easy to kind of get into kind of creepy stuff around that. We didn't have a video, a VHS player or Beta player until very later, much later. Mm-hmm. So my experiences of horror films, firstly, were from my older siblings going to the going all the way into town and seeing a movie and coming back and verbally describing what they'd seen. And this is then one night I remember in particular, my brother had went and seen Alien, and it was whatever year that was that it came out, 1979. And the little kids were sitting around the table, and he came back in and he's like, "Oh my God, I've just seen this movie." And he just, and he basically, his mind was so blown that he described it like sequence for sequence of what happened. And I can still to this day remember exactly as if I was seeing the movie what he had experienced, because he was just translating his pure terror of what he just experienced. Like, you know, describing the thing with the like silver helmet like thing that came, and that guy's blood spraying. And we're sitting there just going, "What the hell is this?" And I felt like I'd seen the movie before I saw the movie. And then when I saw the movie, it was exactly what he just literally just been seared into his brain and just come home and told everyone else what he'd seen.
It didn't let you down.
It was amazing. But it's amazing what's amazing about that is the power of that movie to impress upon someone to then go and describe exactly what the experience was and to capture it just because of their pure emotional response to something. So that was pretty interesting. And I always thought that was kind of interesting, the you experience a film through that method of not actually seeing it but hearing about it. And then from after that, besides kind of catching the odd kind of thing, you know, on television where I'd be watching things late at night and probably things I shouldn't be watching, you know, Hitchcock movies or Hammer films or spooky kind of movies, friends, you know, inevitably the friend whose parents didn't give a crap what they watched, they'd go to the video store and rent the most hardcore horror films of all time. and they'd be just like, "Hey, do you want to watch, you know, Evil Dead or Texas Chainsaw?" I'm like, "Yeah, cool. What's that?" And, you know, it's funny, the first time I saw Texas Chainsaw, I went to a friend's house who's, you know, they're a fairly rough kind of family in like the rough part of town, but he's actually my cousin, so we used to hang out there. And then I remember, you know, I stayed there one night, used to go and, you know, hang out at a friend's place and stay, and they like put this movie on. And it's really interesting actually because I'd never seen anything like that because, you know, I felt we were fairly conservative. And I watched it. I can't actually remember at all 1 second of seeing the film, but because I was probably in a sort of catatonic state trying to process what I was seeing. And then later that night, I basically, you know, was sleeping on the floor of my friend's room and I woke up and I was actually in the film. I can only describe it as like a waking dream where I woke up. I didn't know where I was, but I was in a room in that house in the film, and it was so real and so overwhelming that I was kind of like stumbling around the dark, screaming, looking for the door because I could hear the chainsaws. I could sense I was in the film. And all that's to say how powerful that experience was as a piece of cinema, partially because I hadn't been exposed to it and partially because it's just an incredibly powerful, deeply unsettling piece of storytelling. And which later, you know, that's kind of really got me into gear thinking, wow, if you can – and I was studying art, so, you know, I was – you know, my path was to go and be an artist, to be a fine artist, and, you know, I was studying painting and drawing for 5 years. But I was always drawn to the power of cinema as a thing to be able to transform how you feel. And, you know, when you get it right, whatever the genre it is, it always just amazed me that you could basically transport someone into an entirely different world, an entirely different way of seeing the world of feeling. And horror is just, you know, it can be such a powerful thing to tell a story like that. And films like, you know, seeing Alien finally and seeing, you know, Jaws and seeing Texas Chainsaw and seeing Evil Dead and seeing all those formative kind of movies, you can, you know, you see these things and go, wow, it's kind of amazing how you can put up these series of abstract images and some sound and music and create this incredible impression in human beings. So that was kind of, I was kind of interested after that point.
Yeah. So when did you transition from focusing on fine art over to film and how did that happen?
I was studying painting and drawing for 4 or 5 years. And then all the way through that, I was just obsessed with movies. I'd see every film. I was following filmmakers. I was reading everything about films, but I wasn't thinking there was something that I could do. And I think I got kind of very close to the end of finishing my fine arts degree, and I just knew that this was just not, you know, going into the kind of very specific fine art world. I just thought, you're making art for such a tiny little audience, unless you're a hugely famous artist. Whereas if you make films, your job is to try and tell stories that entertain the world. And that just seemed like such a cool, fun thing to do. Plus, you get to do all the arts. You get to do music, you know, sound, image, photography, you know, everything that I was fascinated with, you know, you get to play with. So after I left art school, I basically went to – I went on a kind of sabbatical and went and worked at a mine in the outback for a while just to get a complete –
You said a mine?
Yeah, mine.
The opal mines? Okay. Is it the opals? Because that was a big thing for a long time.
No, it was basically, it was a gold mine in the middle of the outback. And I went there to just kind of have a completely, so I went from art school to working in a mine with a bunch of miners.
Yeah, like you do.
As a way to just completely reset. Yeah. And then did that and then thought, I don't think this is for me. And then I went back and then started trying to think about how to get into to film and just started, you know, making short films with my friends. And I had a Super 8 camera, so I started shooting stuff with that. And then... just started trying. I tried to get into some film schools. I couldn't get into any film schools because I don't know. I just wasn't good enough, I guess. And then, you know, then I had a weird kind of path from there. Very simply, I applied. There was this kind of competition going on where you could advance your career, whatever your dream was. It was this, you know, competition thing, and I put in this application. I won it. And so I wanted a little bit of money, and I basically thought, well, what am I going to do now? I can make this short film I wanted to make, but I realized I had no idea how to work or talk to actors. So I thought, I better go to drama school to learn directing so I can learn. So when I do get to make a film, I actually can work with actors. So I spent a year in drama school at a place called NIDA in Sydney, which is our drama school, and spent a year studying, you know, playwriting and working with actors and putting on plays and stuff. And that was an amazing experience because suddenly I was able to understand that writing and directing are very similar, and that there's a continuity to the whole art form, and it's not something, because I wasn't very good at English at school, and I thought I could never do that. And then it told me that you can, if you can think and you can, you know, act, I mean, they're just so connected. I didn't realize there was a connection there was, and then I started to write, and then I just thought, well, I could write something, and then I started to write stories and write scripts, and I wrote a bunch of scripts and kind of went from there.
How much did the isolation of, like, say, the childhood or the rural living come to influence the kind of the – there's obviously more of a sense of dread. Your childhood sounds great. So I'm assuming it wasn't so much the childhood, the sense of dread that you portray in the outback and experiences like that, or is that coming more from the mining experience?
I think it's basically, you know, when you grow up, I mean, I don't know. It's from a number of different strands. And I think it's partly to do with if you grow up in the country in Australia – There's a certain amount of folklore you just hear along the way that feeds itself, you know, it eventually feeds back into things later on. You know, you hear stories of, you know, you hear, you know, uncles or cousins or brothers who go traveling and then come back and tell stories about things that happened or strange things that happened and or spooky stories, and you just kind of absorb that. But I think also particularly in Australia there's quite a long history of you know, outback gothic kind of storytelling traditions in painting and in literature and in film. So it's not a new thing, the notion that there is scary things out there and there are scary people out there. And there's a whole tradition of, you know, painting where, you know, when Australia was first, you know, colonized, it was already inhabited by the Aboriginal people. It was basically the dumping ground for the scum of England, who were brought there and just dumped to die, basically.
That movie, The Proposition.
Yeah. Well, basically, that was how – that's what happened when white people were just dumped there. Yeah. There was like – it was a prison. It was like, go here to die. And that's kind of where we started. So when you think about how our origin was you know, the scum of the earth who they wanted to get out of England to just dump in an island to hopefully just all kill themselves or do something. There's a lot of madness and craziness and violence and death in our history.
They've advanced a long way to Mick Taylor.
That's right.
It's just incredible how far they've come.
Well, the funny thing is, he's, you know, the second movie we got to explore, you know, what his personality is about. Yeah. And it's about that. Yeah. His character is basically, he's still pissed off about the fact that, you know, the Brits dumped us there, and, you know, that's why he hates British people.
Oh, yeah, it's always palms or krauts, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, and you look, there's, you know, the English, you know, historically, in terms of, you know, they were the bad guys for the people they colonized. I mean, look at, you know, in American history as well. There's a reason why in Star Wars it resonates that all the bad empire guys speak in a British accent.
Yeah. Well, I've always thought America and Australia, like, I'm from New Zealand, and our history is so much more peaceful than that of Australian American. Yeah. Well, no, they are, because they came over, we traded blankets and guns for all the land. And we made a deal and we signed the Treaty of Waitangi and it was like, we're all good to go. Yeah. It's a problem now. But Australia, just like America, it's born now. In blood.
Yeah, yeah.
It's totally. Born in the...
How do you make movies out of that, Elric? You just don't.
You have to make fantasy, like Peter Jackson,
I guess. I was going
to
say, yeah, yeah.
You make Lord of the Rings. But it's far less, you know, fraught. Yeah. You get the piano. That's what you get. But like Australia and America have so many similarities in terms of like... almost near annihilation of a population, and how that's going to come back, you know, 100 years later,
absolutely.
To affect the culture. It's like Rabbit Proof Fence and
movies. I mean, there are definitely parallels between, you know, between both countries in that level. I mean, different strands. I mean, you know, it evolved. You know, that origin of Australia evolved to become a. It means that we have a quality of kind of egalitarianism, and we also every Australian hates authority.
We have
a natural hatred of authority, just as a cultural thing. And we're a nation of shit stirrers. We basically like to cause trouble and we hate authority. And it goes back to the fact that the authority when we started were these British bastards who dumped us there and basically then ruled us, you know, horribly. Yeah. So the Irish, I'm Scottish Irish, you know, it's a whole thing. But anyway, getting back to the topic, all this stuff in our history kind of, you know, in some kind of little way found its way into the character of Mick Taylor, who is basically a, you know, deeply resentful character who's a little bit annoyed about the fact that, you know, all these cultural things that are, you know, still bubbling away down there. And, you know, in modern Australia, all these things are kind of, you know, quaint history. But for some people, they're not, you know, and a lot of that... deep-seated kind of xenophobia and racism, sexism and homophobia, all that stuff's kind of stuffed down there somewhere. And America has exactly the same version of that. Every country has the same version of this character. There are people who think that they carry with them these things into the now that really should have been left in the past. You know what I mean?
It's showing right now, yeah.
They're still struggling with these things, the battles that were fought and lost.
Yeah. Did you know any, without the serial killer angle, did you know any mix? Because I have to tell you one story. My wife's married to my sister. That's Freudian. My sister's married to lives in Coolum Beach and is married to an Aussie guy.
Yeah.
And he spent a lot of time in the outback where he would tell stories growing up, like running out of gas and his mom having to stand there with a shotgun while the dad had to get gas because that's kind of the. And he told me one story that he was camping by himself in the middle of nowhere where you'd have to be miles from anyone. Fire's going, and a guy just walks out of the darkness and goes, "Hey, mate, can I sit here?" And he sat there, and he said, "The guy was when he saw Wolf Creek, he's like, I've met that guy."
Yeah, no,
it's pretty scary.
I've heard a couple of stories like that, and you know, people who spend time in the outback and go camping and stuff, you hear some pretty strange stories about that kind of thing where you meet someone, you just don't know whether you've met someone who's completely insane or not, and because the distances are so huge, it means that you know Australia's basically. A big island, desert island, with some cities hanging on the edge and everyone hanging close to the beach and, you know, inside that island is this thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of desert.
Yeah.
And a few little towns. And so the stretches between the towns are hundreds of miles. I mean, we were driving, my wife and I were driving, I live on the east coast in Melbourne, but we were on the west coast in Western Australia, and my family's in Western Australia now. And we went for a trip up north, so we went from the west coast all the way up. And there's really nothing. There's a few towns, and then once you get past the towns, there's 4 or 5 hours of nothing. Jesus. And you might drive for an hour, and you see one car. It's like,
wow. Yeah.
And it's like, and it starts to get a little bit creepy. And when we did that trip, actually, we arrived at the place we were going to, and as we were driving up there, we started to get a little bit uneasy, like. You know, this is a bit scary. And we started to think, wow, what if we just got stuck here? And when she heard that what happened on that trip was there was a, you know, a fairly nasty story about a woman who broke down the side of the road and needed petrol. And this guy pulled up, you know, to help her. And it didn't end well. Mm. So it's just, you know, it's the isolation. Part of it's the isolation. Part of it's the fact that, you know, there's also lots of lovely, wonderful people who live out there. But there's also some pretty nasty
history. I did appreciate that you had a nice Maori heroine in your series.
Isn't she great?
Rachel
House.
Yeah, it was nice to have a Kiwi in there. You had one.
I saw a dot and a kangaroo, and I knew all the terrors of Australia. I don't know. Have you ever seen this? I have. They used to air it. It's called Dot and a Kangaroo. They aired it on HBO all the time, and my mom would just plop me down in front of it. But it's about, like, it's kind of like a mixture of live action and animation. And they would use kind of like a plate, which is a live action plate, and then animate things in front of it. But they always had, there was like some little girl that like fell into a creek, and then she got swept away, and then she's in Australia, and then shit goes crazy. And I was just like, oh my God.
They have a lot of things that can kill you there, though. Yeah. I'd visit her, and there'd be spiders the bunyip, the size man. Of your hand. And
the bunyip was the like bunyip. A big thing. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, the stuff that you were exploring with Mick in Wolf Creek 2, was that kind of excised from Wolf Creek 1? Did you kind of insert some of those character shades and then just to discover that they didn't belong in this first film?
In the first film, I specifically decided not to reveal anything to do with his backstory.
Right.
Because, you know, usually, which I thought would help build to the mystery and the, you know, the first film was thematically about the notion that... Yeah, a bit like Strangers on a Train by Hitchcock. You could be traveling in your life, and then without knowing it, you cross someone's path, and that person could be like a Mick Taylor character. And when I was researching the true characters, you know, the true crime cases that Wolf Creek was kind of based on, the overriding kind of tragic feeling and scary, terrifying feeling of those stories was, wow, this person was just traveling that way, and they just happened to, at that moment, at that time, cross that road and see that guy, and that changed everything. And what happened from there was this incredible... horrific thing, but the randomness of that, the randomness of sudden violence, the randomness of sudden death, to me that was kind of the scariest thing that you just don't know who you're talking to. Yeah. So the first one was specifically designed to not reveal anything about Mick. We don't know anything about who he is. There's no backstory. There's no, oh, when I was young, my mom did this, or I didn't get my PlayStation I wanted, or whatever.
Which is a lot scarier. You're making an like Jaws. I mean, he's right. Like a shark, right, that you come across.
Yeah, to feel there's no motivation explained is pretty scary. And then, which means that the second film, we then had, the audience knew who Mick was, so we couldn't play that gag. So it was front and center. So we open up with him in a great set piece to say, I'm back. And then basically the movie then becomes about just a relentless drive all the way till he gets an audience member, which is the guy that he captures, the British guy. And then he can basically, then we see what Mick's about, which is, I'm just going to screw with your head. Because, you know, that's what I do. And I'm just going to get, I derive pleasure from hearing my own voice. I'm an entertainer and I'm actually, you know, this is my version of a fun time. And we get to see all of these prejudices and all of these things and all the machinations of what makes him tick start to spill out.
He likes being in control. He's the control. With the first one, though, what are some of the, I mean, people might not even know, they were called the Backpack Murders. Were they all mysteries still to this day, or some of them were they solved?
Ivan Marco is the one that I researched.
Wasn't the trial going on while the movie was releasing?
No, there's two different cases, and the one that was affected, the movie was a different case, but a similar kind of thing. Ivan Milat was the guy who was the backpacker killer, and he basically he was caught and convicted of killing seven backpackers, foreign backpackers in Australia, but only after he'd been doing it for like 20 years. And that's the ones that they could find. And they also think that there may be 20 other bodies of people went missing in that period who were on the same stretch of road that he was working on, and have never been, you know, so it was jail for seven, but it's pretty much sure guaranteed that there was many, many, many more we'll never know about. So that was one case that kind of, you know, played a big part in determining the actual character and psychology of Mick. The other one was the Joanna Lees case.
That's where, the one that was in trial.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. So that was a case that was much, much closer to when the film was made, where a British couple was driving in Western Australia. A car drove up behind them on this desert highway. This car came up behind them and yelled out, there's something wrong with your car, pull over. They pulled over. The boyfriend, it was a boyfriend and girlfriend traveling. The boyfriend walked up to the front of the other car, and then she heard a gunshot. And then this guy came and tried to, you know, abduct her. And he put her in the back of the truck and then, tied her up and stuff. And as you were under the front, was starting to put the boyfriend's body in his truck. She escaped and she ran into the night. And she was basically, he pursued her he had a dog and a torch. She was hiding and, you know, it was a fairly horrific thing. And then basically she waited there all night, and then she saw him go. And then she went out into the highway and waved down a truck, and they took her into town. And she said, this is what's happened. And to this day, they've never found the boyfriend. They've never found the body of the boyfriend.
Mm.
But they did find that guy because they found a DNA. They somehow DNA matched him with this crime and realized that this was the guy. And then he was in trial when the Wolf Creek movie was coming out. And then we got a letter from the Chief Justice of Northern Territory who said, you know, dear producers of this film, you can't show this film until we finish this trial because it might influence the jury. Wow. You know.
Hmm. What about the, I mean, I think the, for me, because I had actually seen, you know, here John Jarrett would be an unknown, but like I always liken it, it'd be like if Steve Martin was cast. I mean, he's like a comedian. He's a major supporting actor. He's always in things.
Yeah.
Did you have a very clear vision of how he looked, how he talked, or did he, how much of that was invention on his part? And
well, it's interesting you say that because basically before this movie, you know, John Jarrett was, I always describe him as the Tim Allen of Australia.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
He was in a gardening show. So he was known to the public. He had a gardening show that was a DIY show where he and his wife would say, "Today, folks, we're going to fix a garden fence and get down there, get the shoes out." Blah, blah. And that was him every Friday night. And it was like, you know, I am John Jarrett. And he was a good Aussie bloke, everyone, lovable character. That was his persona. And he'd also obviously an actor in, you know, of other films, but he was always playing like the goofy, nice Aussie guy. And then when I was at Night at the Drama School, I saw him in a play and he was playing a completely different character. It was a play called Dead Heart, which later became a movie. And John was playing in Brian Brown played this role on the movie version, but on stage John played this outback racist violent cop. Mm. And I saw him and thought, wow, God, he's an amazing actor. And B, I just never thought he would have that in him. Mm. And then when we came to cast the movie, I just thought, wouldn't that be bonkers to have John Jarrett rock up, and he's the guy? Because I thought that, you know, the Ivan Milat who'd killed those people, they all willingly got into his vehicle because when they first met him, he's a lovely, fun, lovely guy,
like Bundy,
Bundy.
Bundy was so good at that.
And then at some point, his persona dropped, and he's just, you know, completely insane psychopath. But what fascinated me was the notion of this. You know, you never know. That's the thing. That's the scary thing about serial killers. You just never know what you're dealing with. But yeah, so then I met with John, and then, you know, within 20 minutes I knew he was the guy because he sat down. He loved the script, and he sat down and said, you know, I know this character. And I'm like, you know, what do you mean you know the character? He said, well, I grew up in way outback Queensland, which is there's outback, then there's outback. Yeah. And he grew up in the outback, as in, you know, very rough. Not much to do except fight, and the other word that starts with F. And they would on a Saturday night to just get paralytically drunk, beat the shit out of each other, and try and find, you know, something to do. It was a very, very rough way to grow up. And he basically based the character on his dad, not the serial killing part, but the toughness and the walk and the whole thing. Mm. And he said, look, I'm just going to do an impersonation of my dad, who's a really tough outback kind of guy. Mm. And the humor and the sayings are all from that generation, which is kind of my dad's generation as well. Yeah. So his father, John's older than I am, but his father, there's just an old-timey way of talking that is unique to the Australian outback or Australian rural, kind of rural areas. And he adopted all those sayings. And, you know, I was sort of fascinated with those, that way of speaking, because I felt like we didn't really celebrate that enough in Australia as being a particular thing. And I wanted to bring back all those crazy sayings and things because I thought it'd be really interesting to hear them, particularly coming out of the mouth of someone who became like that.
And how has his take on Mick either changed, or how has he responded to kind of slipping back into the role, grown over the years, and how has it changed? Has he just fully, like, you know, because you look at these kind of like actors who have essayed boogeymen, you know, Robert Englund and Candyman, you know, Tony Todd, and they, at first, you know, it's like kind of like it's a character essay, you know, and then it becomes part of their persona, like in a fun way, you know?
No, definitely. Yeah. I mean, the first movie as an actor, he had to try and work out how to play the character.
Right.
And he, you know, when we were in pre-production for the movie, he went away into the outback on a road trip by himself for a couple of weeks while we were prepping. Just to try and think about it, try and work it out and think how the hell, how's he trying to go through, understand that kind of psyche.
Right.
And he, you know, he brought a lot of ideas to it. He basically brought, you know, the laugh, he had to get in and believe that mindset, which is a really tough thing to do as an actor. And the most important thing he had to do was to not judge the character's decisions in an honest way as an actor, is to think like that and see the world like that and not judge it. And John's the opposite of any of those qualities. John's, you know, he's got 8 kids. He's just a lovely, fun, great guy to be with. Yeah. But he had to be this, you know, horrific, you know, character. And, you know, the non-judgment thing was a big thing, you know, to be able to embrace that and willingly be what Mick, you know, do what Mick does. Because Mick loves what he does.
Yeah.
He's thrilled to be killing people. Yeah. He thinks it's the greatest thing. He's living the dream, you know, in as far as how he sees the world. Mm-hmm. And he's also doing a, you know, social justice because he thinks that basically foreign people are vermin and they should be killed. And that's just how it is.
And city slickers. A bunch of city slickers get. There's a moment. This is one of those movies that I feel kind of similarly about Martyrs, where whether people like the movie or not, I feel like it's a really important and really powerful, like violent film where you actually feel violence as violence, not just as aesthetic.
Yeah.
But there's a moment in that movie where, you know, I'd put it down maybe top 10 horror moments. And it's an acting beat of Jared. And you probably, I mean, I'm going to guess everyone felt it. I felt chills when I started when they're around the campfire and the guy goes, oh, but you've got a great job. You're up in the helicopter and, you know, you must be great fun. And the way Jared just looks at him and it's silence.
Yeah.
The whole movie changes on a dime and it's all performance and silence based.
Right.
Which is, and for that to be the scariest moment in a horror film is pretty crazy. Like it's pretty unique. And was that something, I mean, was that a decision on his part or was that something you guys were just creating? That was the you know, precise turn of the events?
Well, I mean, going into the film, I was very aware of the fact that when you look at a movie like Deliverance, and this again speaks to what this movie is really about, you know, the horror in Deliverance is you have a person from this world and a person from this world. And when they meet, their points of view are so alien that they're basically different species. They're human, but that's the horror. And so when you have, like, you know, a young 20-something surfy from Sydney meeting a character like Mick, the terror is the fact when you realize that you are different species, one's a killer, one's a victim, in that moment you realize this is what this is. This is a rabbit and this is a wolf. And that moment his mask drops for a second and then it's chilling because you realize he's gonna kill him.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of, you know, deep connect, you know, it's an intellectual idea, but we managed to get it across because it goes back to that Deliverance thing where you go, these people, that's the terror. There's a social terror. And that's actually, you
adapt
know,
or die too.
That's right.
If you take on the character, so in Deliverance, if you take on the characteristics of the other, you might survive.
That's right.
And I think you've done that. I don't want to jump ahead too far into the series, but that's what the series seems to be about versus the movies.
Yeah, yeah.
She has to adapt to become to survive the outback. This character, and we'll talk about more.
Well, what's interesting? What's interesting about Wolf Creek is that it maintains, and you're talking about the kind of judgmentalness of the character, you know, non-judgmentalness that that John had to take towards the character. This isn't a character that you ever once side with. This isn't a character in which you take any kind of glee watching him be completely, you know.
Not at all.
And like even in Wolf Creek 2 has its sensational kind of like outrageous moments, but you still know there's something wrong about it. I think there was like one moment where I giggled a moment and I felt really bad about it at the end of Wolf Creek 1 where he's in a car and he's just toying with her.
Right.
And he's revving the engine and he does this one little thing. And I was like, oh no, he's this bored asshole out in the middle of nowhere who wants a toy with anything that gets in his way. And I felt really bad about laughing about it because it was really strange. But this isn't in the kind of horror pantheon of villains. This is one you shouldn't like.
No, that's right.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that really set Wolf Creek apart from a lot of the other films that came out around that time is that you really like the victims in this film and you really despise the other guy. Like in Hostel, I was like, oh, these guys are assholes. Go ahead, do what you do. But this one, like you love everyone in it and despise him so much. And so it's really impactful.
Look grounded. They're more grounded.
Yeah, I want to get real with you right now, Greg, because I rewatched the movie.
We've been before?
I really do want to discuss this. I guess it would be tone and it's a lot of the things that Ryan and Becca just hit on. I saw the movie when it came out, the original Wolf Creek. I just revisited it this week in prep for, you know, when you were coming on. And I'd say the first 45, 50 minutes I love, you know, because I'm like, oh, I love these characters. They're great. Have an incredible crush on the lead girl immediately. I love the moment where they share their first kiss. Right. It's like all this great stuff.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I don't know. Why did I not revisit this in a while? And pretty much Elric's moment, the turn.
Right.
Okay. So me, I'm a very sensitive horror fan. I like horror, but when it gets nasty, it upsets me personally. So revisiting the movie, I just remember that it upset me when I initially saw it, and it upset me a lot this time, which is what horror is supposed to do. Mm. Certain types of horror. It depends what kind of horror you want. But it was funny because I was having a conversation right after I saw it with a friend, explaining the movie to them and explaining why I'm like, you know what? I don't know. It's a beautifully made film, but like it bothers me when it takes that turn.
Right.
And then my friend challenged me and is like, well, what's the difference between that and Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Because you love the original Chainsaw Massacre. Right, yeah. And I really started to think about it. And I'm like, is it the fact that it's women? Like, you know, like in Chainsaw, it's mostly men victims. And then the final person is the Sally Harvester character that escapes. There is, you know, and I was like, Wolf Creek is kind of the reversal because it's the female characters. And they don't just get killed. It's long, it's drawn out, and it really affects you, as it should. Whereas, and spoiler if you haven't seen Wolf Creek, all the women die, and the male's the one that you don't expect to get out of it.
Right.
So you know what I mean? I almost felt like it's a reversal.
You got one other factor, which it could be, which is the distancing effect of a 30-year-old movie versus a movie that's now.
Sure.
Know, when it's 30 years ago, you're watching characters from the 70s, and it's still effective.
Yeah, yeah. There might be a disconnect, but yeah, you're seeing characters that you recognize.
I have a theory as well, boys. Okay. So my theory on this is that in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the villains definitely fall more into a caricature line. Look at Leatherface. He's totally surreal. I mean, nothing like that exists that we could identify and say, oh, I know a guy like that. Or the hitchhiker. Oh, I know a guy like that. It just doesn't exist. But Mick, I feel like we all kind of know a guy that.
And I guess when I'm not really asking a question. I'm just kind of telling you
I have an answer for your feeling.
Well, good. Because,
answer my feelings.
Well, because as the filmmaker, I assume that was the intent. You're making a horror movie to affect the viewer and not celebrate the villain.
I think the primary thing is that I wasn't actually making a horror movie. Mm-hmm.
Boom.
What?
This podcast is over, sir. Your marching order.
The romantic comedy podcast is down the road. No, because basically the explanation for the feelings that you're having about it being uncomfortable and deeply unsettling and kind of dirty watching it is because, you know, to me, making it as not a horror film, and specifically when we're making it, I was saying, we're not making a horror film. We specifically said to the composer, we're not scoring, don't make a scary score.
Sure.
Score the genuine emotion of the characters, and let's try and tell it, let's try and take a story like that real case that we know about, and let's try and describe how it really would be. So let's not sensationalize the kills. The kills aren't cool. The kills are disgusting. Mm. And what the film's doing is, as a film and as a filmmaker, what it's trying to do is to say, you know, yeah, we see all this violence on TV and we see all these bullshit horror movies and it's all like, it's all so easy and so glamorized. What's it really look like when the specific thing I was trying to look at and film was the kind of bizarreness of the social exchange between what happens when someone's in that situation. So when you are with someone in a regular social situation, you're at dinner, we all see hundreds of people every day, the society that we exist in. Mm-hmm. What's it like when you get into a situation where you actually genuinely are in an experience where someone is like that, and what does it look like? What's it really look like? And what it looks like is disgustingly horrible and mundane and filthy and horrible, and it makes you feel devastated to watch it because that's what murder looks like.
Yeah.
And when you look into serial killers and you look into their lives, as I unfortunately had to when I was researching it, you realize these are the most desperately sad, tragic human beings imaginable because they're so, you know, and this is not in a judgmental way. I mean, it's obvious they're twisted and obviously they're evil, but ultimately they're the saddest human beings who ever lived because they're completely devoid of humanity.
Yeah.
And the specific thing that makes the film really disturbing is, you know, showing a character who basically is devoid of human compassion. And so once you have a human being who can treat other human beings with zero human compassion and as an object, then you have real horror. And the history is full of
empathy. Once you can
objectify a human being as not human or as not having, not understanding, not having that compassionate gene or that empathy, you're one step from pure evil. And Mick is a pure, pure evil character because he is someone who completely devoid of human compassion.
Well, I think what Rob's getting at, which I really liked about the film, but I totally knew, get on board with what he's saying, is the idea of extinguishing a dream that every human, you know, if you hear 100 people died in an earthquake, every one of those was 100 dreams, 100 futures that were extinguished. But usually in horror films, it's like a trope. It's a right. type of person, yeah. not a dreamer. It's just a character. And so we yeah. can get over it really quick. But in this, you've actually portrayed them as people with futures.
Yeah.
And then the future doesn't get to happen.
And that's
a yeah. pretty dark thing to have to witness.
I'm just like wow. seriously depressed right now.
All right. Rough, so man. Let's talk about that alligator and Rogue.
That alligator did have dreams, guys.
That alligator yeah. did have dreams. But I think that, that's, you know, that those were the things that, you know, I was thinking about while I was making it were, you know, it's not a horror film. We're just going to try and describe it realistically. And because of that, it became a good horror film. Mm-hmm. Like, that wasn't the intention. And I always feel like to me, you know, and there's an interesting example of this. You know, some of the greatest horror films are by directors who don't want to be doing horror films.
Sure.
And the reason is because what they go in and identify is the essence of human emotion. And they accidentally make great horror films because they're not focused on horror films. They're focused on human emotion. A couple of examples of directors who did one horror film and then went off to do other films. Steven Spielberg and Jaws. Mm-hmm. Well, you could argue Poltergeist. It's Toby Hooper's movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ridley Scott and Alien. Stanley Kubrick in The Shining. William Friedkin and The Exorcist. Mm. Fairly significant horror films by directors who went into the genre, who were great storytellers who made a dozen other films in other genres. But what's fascinating is the fact that when they dipped into horror and they weren't – what they were interested in was basically the power of the emotion, the power of the human experience. The other stuff is what it is, but they happened to make some of the best horror films of all time.
I'm making it real, and I think that's where all of them – and Polanski had added to that, even though he's flirted more with genre than the rest of them. But they make – we had Jordan Peele last week kept using the same words, and I couldn't – you couldn't put it better, which is they grounded – people right. into reality right. versus tropes and types. And yeah. that's a big difference in yeah. horror right now, mm-hmm. I think.
I think that's the, you know, Stephen King quote, which I had written while I was writing the script, without first belief there can be no fear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Ridley Scott's quote, you know, the whole job of the filmmaker is to create a believable world. And if filmmakers aren't focused on creating a believable world and believable characters, it doesn't really matter what, you know, how good your demon, ghost, monster, whatever it is. You have to be focused on quality craft as a storyteller first, in my opinion, and then you can do whatever you like. But you've got to have that realism.
Well, your fellow country person, Babadook, I'm just thinking, because you can have a ridiculous drawing monster and be scared of it because you believe the story first.
Right.
I believe those two people yeah. existed, which yeah. is cool.
So kind of delving into the sequel and the series, you know, Wolf Creek comes out. I would never have imagined sequel,
right?
TV show, yeah. books, you know. So for
bobbleheads.
Bobbleheads. I get because we have bobbleheads of like every villain and horror character ever. But
we were excited.
But what was the I don't know the attraction to the engine that was driving Mick Taylor that deserved exploration for you? You know, I mean, like the books were one thing, and then now, and when the TV show got started, I was like, wow, we're really going for it, you right. know?
Isn't there a chain of restaurants now in Australia too? Did Mix? I hear that? Mix, yeah. yeah.
They really? Serve the backpacker burger?
Yeah. One of our writers on Blumhouse.com wrote about a pop-up bar.
Oh, no, right, okay.
Okay.
So that was a promotion for the series.
Okay, because one of our writers actually went to it and like right. wrote, I'm at the Wolf Creek restaurant right now. No, okay.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a pop-up bar.
Right in the middle of a big crater. There's a little pop-up.
There's two things with that. One is when Stan, who produced the series in Australia, were promoting the show, he did an incredible job of promoting the show. They created this pop-up bar. So it was an outback kind of bar experience that they did in Melbourne and City to promote this series.
We don't have pop-up bars. Like, we have pop-up clothing stores here
right.
in the U.S.
Okay. So. We have pop-up everything in Australia. and then we had – and then separate to that, this is completely separate. I have been joking – my wife and I always joke that, oh, wouldn't it be funny? Because in Australia we have this thing where every state has the big something. In Queensland there's the big pineapple, and it's a, you know – 25-foot tall pineapple. It's a tourist attraction. There's the big koala in Victoria. There's the big shrimp in Queensland. There's
Aussie
big,
World has something. What, yeah, I went to there.
What are these things made? It's just like a big giant,
just like big statues.
Shrimp.
Like a giant, okay. giant tour, and people go and take the photograph in front of it.
Yeah.
My thought was creating the big Mick in Western Australia, and you have like a 25-foot tall Mick standing there, like that, and you
holding a woman's head,
and then you put a little restaurant chain under it. And it's like a, you know, murder. I mean, it's a hideous idea, as I say it.
What you do is you position a restaurant right between his legs.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Right. And you, there you go.
Do you guys remember? Sorry, this just flashed me back.
And it's all back. It's all backpacker themed, like, you know, backpacker right, burger, which is actually backpacker meat. And
this just flashed me back to my childhood. Do you guys remember that there used to be a chain of restaurants on the East Coast named after Paul Bunyan? Yes. Or it might have been, and it was like you would pull up, and it might have been hotels or something, but there were these giant Paul Bunyan statues.
It's in Fargo.
He's holding an axe. Yeah. I remember we always passed one on the way, the drive down Virginia to my cousin's house in Kentucky, and we always would go past this like giant fucking Paul Bunyan.
But he didn't kill people, did he?
I don't know. He had an axe. Okay, still pretty terrifying. He had the killer beard.
You're slandering Bunyan.
All right, but really quick, going back to, I'm just like curious for you personally,
the other thing that was going through my mind when I was making it was, you know, why isn't there an Australian horror con?
Yeah.
Why don't we have a Freddy? Why don't we have a Jason?
Right, right, right.
Why don't we make one?
So come on, Razorback. No.
Razorback's pretty good.
Yeah.
I don't know why there's not more sequels.
Need some sequels, yeah.
So that was part of my thing. So part of the iconic look of Mick, which is and he always has this, he always looks the same, always wears the same thing, was trying to come up with an iconic costume for him and a look for him that was immediately recognizable, that would be this horror icon that was particular Australian. So essentially we took the, you know, look and quality of Crocodile Dundee, added a little bit of Steve Irwin, and there's an Australian country singer called Slim Dusty. So we took elements of all of those iconic Australian figures and put them into one character visually, and he, you know, made Mick Taylor. And, you know, there you go.
We have a question somewhat related to that off of our Facebook page that just came in. How does Australian attitudes towards the horror genre differ from America's, or does it?
I think there's a more – I mean, there's certainly a big horror community in Australia. We have a much smaller – it's a much – obviously much smaller market in terms of, you know – so it's much smaller, I think. In the States, it's just such a vibrant horror scene. There's just so many fans, so many conventions and things. In Australia, it's, you know, there's the same passion for it, but it's just – it's on a much smaller scale because there's just – you know, America is just such a giant country.
Mm. When the first Wolf Creek came out in Australia, was it difficult for audiences there that already recognized John to make that separation, or did his performance pretty much win them over?
I think it worked doubly powerfully for them because they had a perception of who he was. They had no idea that when he appeared, they thought that's what he was. And then when he turned around and started killing people, they just blew their brains out. They were just like,
wow, okay.
And actually, that was something that I kind of, you know, borrowed from Psycho, the notion of having, you know, a character arrive who you think is the good guy and then just flip him around, but also having the lead female character who you think is the final girl because she kind of looks like Jamie Lee Curtis in First Halloween, and then you take her all the way through and then she gets, you know, killed horribly and you're like, oh my God. So flipping all those expectations was something we were playing with as well.
Right.
But going back to your question about, you know, the story engine for Mick being making a second film in the books, you know, the answer really to that is when we were making it, we were thinking, you know, part of the design was saying, wouldn't it be great if we made a character that felt really uniquely Australian, that was speaking very Australian? Because at that time, there was hardly any horror films being made in Australia. I mean, it was still very much like they were looked down on and very, you know, you're doing horror films, oh my God, that's horrible. So I was very conscious of trying to make something as good as I possibly could so that we could change that trend, but also at the same time making something that was really Australian. Mm. It wasn't trying to be an American horror film because we could never compete, and it was also something of our culture. And so when we finished the movie, I instantly started thinking about other stories we could do for Mick. And I thought, well, you know, he hasn't been explained. We would, what was his backstory? And so we developed the two prequel novels. Mm-hmm. So I worked with Aaron Stearns, who's a great Australian horror novelist, and Brett McBean, another Australian horror novelist, and I developed like a story arc, and then I sat down with those guys and, you know, we co-wrote two novels which told the story of Mick from 8 years old till about 19, and then from 19 till the first film. So it sort of covers that period of time, his story.
Right.
And the second film is basically, you know, we had to change gear in terms of what the movie was. So it was basically now kind of fun because Mick, you could now have fun with the character.
Right, right.
Because now you know what he is. And it's then about saying how far can you go with that character? What's the extreme What do we want to know about him? And the things you want to know is what makes him tick, why is he doing it, where does he live, how does he operate? That was what the second film was all about.
The comparison I've heard a lot is like Texas Chainsaw and Texas Chainsaw 2.
Right.
Like it just goes.
Or Freddy. Well, because for me, that's usually when a horror icon loses a bit of their power is once they become funnier.
Right.
And the one thing that I thought was, because for me, that's what 2 did. Like there's sequences I really like, but I couldn't have sustained a third part in that tone for me.
Right.
But the series takes another total turn and right. totally won me back over in that sense of it becomes a Moby Dick story
yeah.
or a Red Riding Hood story.
Right.
He's only in it like the sharks yeah. and Jaws. He's out there. But,
yeah.
And I really think that really worked for, again, grounding something. Like she's – we'll tell them a little kernel.
Yeah,
I watched the first
yeah,
six because
you watch it. I haven't had a chance to see
yeah.
it yet. But why a TV series as opposed to Wolf Creek 3? Like why that format to continue the story?
We are doing Wolf Creek 3.
Okay.
So Wolf Creek 3 is happening next year. The TV series happened because I actually wrote a franchise Bible of what I wanted to do with the character. And I wrote the outline for a TV series. I wrote a series of novel stories and I wrote the movie series. And there were all the stories that I thought were worth telling with the character. And they all had their self-enclosed arcs. And I just thought this would be a cool thing to do. And coincidentally, I was meeting with a TV producer about something else. And we talked about, and I think he might have just said, oh, wouldn't it be cool to do, a TV series? And I thought about it. And I thought, how could you do that? And, for me, I feel like to keep something going, you have to basically two things. One, actually understand what its essence is. And the other thing is you have to keep reinventing it. And if you look at a franchise like Evil Dead franchise, for example, first one balls out terrifying horror film. Second one, horror comedy. Third one, outright comedy. So I feel like, in order to keep the creators interested and the audience interested, you take the thing that people love most, but then you find a new way to examine that. So the first film is obviously the first film really was an experimental movie. It was, what's it look like if you take something seriously like this, as well as the ideas of creating a horror icon and trying to do something like that. The second movie is saying, well, that worked. The people are interested in the character. Let's explore the character. Let's have fun with him. Let's see what he's about. So the whole movie just sets up mixed modus operandi. The TV series is basically saying, how do you mythologize the character of Mick further? But the problem with a character like Mick or any sort of monster or anything, as soon as you bring him on and put him in the spotlight, it's over. You need to keep putting him in the background and mythologizing them because then it means that you can have people talking about them. Like the shark in Jaws, they spend 50 minutes looking at pictures and saying, oh, sharks are prehistoric, oh, sharks are terrifying, sharks are terrifying. So it's building this image in your mind. So when a shark appears and it's a plastic rubber thing doing this, your brain's overridden that and thought all the deep feelings you have about this thing under the ocean with huge teeth that's primitive and primeval and rip you apart and has no light, it's got lifeless eyes, all that stuff, that's in your brain. So the same way with a character like Mick in the series, he's out there like Colonel Kurtz up the river and the challenge is to find a good cipher for the audience to go in and try and find and unpack this character. And the trick of that is just teasing him. He's always just out of reach or he's just always around. So he's kind of omnipotent in the world because it's his world. But eventually you're going to meet him. And then when you meet him, you've had, five episodes to build up his legend. So the ending becomes very powerful because you've got our new hero with this supervillain. Who's just pure evil.
And she's hunting, no spoilers, but she's hunting them for something he's done. I don't even want, because the first episode's so good, I don't even want to spoil that, but she's hunting him for something he's done. And
yeah.
So it's a totally unique perspective. She's way out of her depth.
Yeah.
She's really young. She's American.
She's American.
Every time there's somebody, American, it comes up every time.
Well,
but
yeah,
it's fun to see that kind of a heroine,
That's right. It's kind of like I set out not to make a horror series, but to make a revenge story and a crime series because it's about trying to understand, this serial killer. And there's naturally really horrific things that happen. And it's really – and we had the incredible experience of basically having a network say, do whatever you want. Go bananas. Go as far as you want, as far as you can. Make it as cinematic as you can. So our directive was to make it, you know, just like the movies.
And there's some answers in there for people who are like interested in myth without spoiling.
Right.
That towards the end of it, there really are. Not, and you, with Syracles, you'll never get an answer fully because no one will ever know if it's biology or how you're up. But there, in all serial killers' lives, you always hear a story of something about whether it's parental or being dressed as a little girl or trapped in a closet, whatever, whatever it is. Some, they always have those kind of signs.
Yeah. And we were lucky enough to have published two novels of mixed backstory
to draw from.
And so we were able to use that in the and say, oh, well, this is what happened. So then it fed into that mythology. And look, the challenge, you know, and this is the challenge with the movies going on as well, is the challenge is to keep mythologizing the character. Once you stop building them once you lose their mythic quality, it becomes, you know, the later kind of Halloween movies where it's just silly. Yeah. There's no fear. It's just the kind of, you know, morbid kind of enjoyment of seeing the character slash people up. It's lost that kind of quality where you actually just genuinely don't understand the character in some sense.
So you'd liken Wolf Creek 3 to Halloween 3. You're going way off the reservation, right? You're just gonna he's not even in it. It's just crazy masks.
I'm going straight to space.
He's with the Australian Space Program.
Mick in space.
Are the series is the tone of the series gonna have any connection to part 3, or is part 3 gonna be more kind of in line with the trajectory of the films?
The movies necessarily have to be balls out terrifying stories just because of the nature of their structure.
Yeah.
The series can do all kinds of crazy things. Mm. And you know, one of the other inspirations for the series were things like Twin Peaks, where you go into a town and you could explore all the characters in town and go spend an episode just exploring this character. And the main character is the narrative driver is pursuing Mick. She meets all these other characters. Mm-hmm. And you get to explore the world of Wolf Creek, which is fundamentally is you hinted at in the movies, but you can now take time to look at all these other amazing, crazy characters, and Mick is one of them. But he's not in every episode.
Yeah. How has we've surpassed Wolf Creek's 10th anniversary, you know, and from that period, you know, we had Wolf Creek, and then we went through a very large period of kind of like the Splat Pack years, and Wolf Creek as a concept kind of transcended all of that because of what you were just talking about, it being not so much a horror film, but you know, like. It's a thriller. It's a psychological thriller. It's an analysis of a killer. And how has horror's evolution over the last 10 years kind of informed or not informed at all, you know, Wolf Creek's evolution from first film to series into what you're going to go into with 3?
It's a good question because, you know, the landscape changes entirely every couple of years.
Yeah.
And you have to be sensitive to that. Like, it's pointless. You know, if you tried to make something like the first film, it just wouldn't make any sense to people because the first film came at a time and was purely created at a time when, and this is interesting in terms of that splat pack thing about, you know, High Tension, about The First Hostel, about a bunch of films at that time. Coincidentally, around the world, and this is weird how this works, a bunch of filmmakers were feeling the same way about horror films. We'd had a long time of self-referential funny horror films, and you know, people of you know the bunch of people around that time all separately felt this thing of why can't we do one that's not funny? Why can't we do one that's basically serious? Why can't we do one that basically is disturbing and isn't winking at the audience? Isn't saying ha ha ha, it's just a joke, isn't horror silly? And why can't we have those Deliverance style 70s, you know, really disturbing experiences in horror? And all these filmmakers suddenly brought out these films quickly in a row. The Saw film almost is into that as well, where they just, it's just, there's no winking irony at it. It's basically, the film ends and it says, yes, the world is terrible and you are going to die horribly. You know, it's not a positive ending. And those films just happen as a reaction to, I believe, the films that had, you know, very good movies, but they became, you know, after the first Scream, which changed everything, there was then, you know, a long time of Scream ripoffs tonally where it was just like, you know, there wasn't really... it was doing a different thing.
We were also coming off a lot of PG-13 horror.
That's right.
Because The Ring, and we just had The Sixth Sense, and all the J-horror remakes, which all were PG-13. So it was kind of horror light. I mean, it was art dread horror, but it was very kind of family-friendly horror.
It wasn't, it seemed to have lost a lot of its bite. And also, you know, one of the things that horror can do as a genre is it can push the envelope. And it's always pushed the envelope because you basically have the scope to delve into disturbing, taboo, deeply disturbing things that are culturally wrong. That's what it can do when it's really switched on and it's really doing it to you. It's like, that's the great thing about horror. It takes the, you know, unlifts your subconscious, allows you to kind of see something you should never really see or say. Or it's the ability to remove all censorship. And that's kind of a fairly powerful thing when it's done right. And we'd had all these movies that had nothing to do with any of that. And all the people started to make these movies that said, you know, let's go for it. Let's go bananas. And then, you know, that was that. And then that was done. And then it was like it was saturated. Then there was all these torture porn films. And naturally, that became boring as well. Mm-hmm. Because they weren't actually doing what the original film set out to do. And then, you know, so the second film, it kind of certainly, I think there was early on people like, oh, who, you know, this is, you know, so 2000, so, you know, not of its period. But they realized we're making an action comedy film. Mm-hmm. And then when they saw the movie, they're like, oh, it's not, you know, and some people even said like torch point. It's like, watch the movie. And like, nothing to do with that. It's actually an character investigation. It's actually an action comedy film or an action suspense film. Because technically I was just interested in suspense. I wanted to, I'd always been fascinated with the idea of a chase. And I thought, what if you could sustain a chase for an entire movie? Wouldn't that be cool? Like duel, mm-hmm. yeah, that kind of thing. How do you, because it's ultimate, you know, Spielberg and Hitchcock both agreed the ultimate form for cinematic story is a chase. And a lot of the films are just chase films. You just, how do you get the MacGuffin? We've got to chase the MacGuffin from here to here, here, here. So in, as a horror film, I thought, wouldn't it be cool just to have Mick just, it's just a pursuit from beginning to end. He catches the guy and we have this other kind of act that's more of a, you know, intermixed brain, but that was the idea of the movie. So it's nothing to do with what the first film was about. And the series, again, was basically saying, you know, we didn't want to make a film that was, you know, slasher. There's a misogynistic element to slasher films. A male character slaughters and catches women and kills them. Not exactly that cool. So we thought, what if we make a female hero and what if she goes and kicks the bad guy's ass or tries to and make it a female empowerment story, but it's still Wolf Creek. And I thought that would be intriguing enough people who like Wolf Creek to say, oh, I thought this was about something else. And suddenly go, well, it's actually just a great crime story. So you kind of, you know, people were interested and curious. And then when they saw the girl with the shotgun on the post, they're like, what the hell is this? And then you realize that what she's up against is like, it becomes dramatically engaging. She's got a young woman in a foreign country against a really bad guy. And the dramatic stakes just go like that. And you get to do all the kind of cool stuff of unpacking the serial killer, but it's through a completely different lens. And if we do another TV series, there's another concept, which again flips the whole thing on its head. And the movies as well, basically, will each one will do it. They're actually different kinds of stories, but using the anchor of this very interesting psycho killer in the outback and seeing different shades of him, but each one of them is a completely different style of story. And they do have to be sensitive to mm-hmm. the time we're in because right. you've got to try and make it connect in some way, what's going on in the world.
And then right. they'll connect your next with Wolf Creek, have Shani Vincent go back home. He's killed everyone in her survivalist cult.
Every week he's trying to figure out how to get
I like
Shani.
Crossovers.
We're gonna make creating Shani universes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're going to make Elric's fan fiction corner.
Yeah, yeah.
I love your next book. That was an awesome movie.
Which, and an Australian heroine. But I was curious about survival in all your films because I don't know too much about. I actually know the producer of your newest one, Dana. But what's it called? With Daniel Radcliffe, the
Jungle.
And now is that? I know it's based on a book, but it's a memoir, a survivalist memoir. Or?
It is the movie. The movie I'm posting right now is called Jungle, and it's that's the one Daniel Radcliffe is starring in. It's a true story, and it's about a guy who met up with two friends in Colombia, in Bolivia, and they were backpacking in 1981. They met a guide who promised them this jungle adventure, this amazing journey into the Amazon for 3 weeks. And they went in with him and it went horribly, horribly wrong. Mm. And only two of them came out alive. And the two that were in there got separated. And the main guy who Daniel plays, called Yossi Ginsberg, he survived by himself in the Amazon for 19 days with nothing. Mm. Wow. So it's this extraordinary real life survival tale that's really scary. It's not a horror film, but it's what he goes through is horrifying because he kind of goes completely insane, as well as being stalked by a jaguar, you know, being eaten, you know, ripped apart by insects. It's an amazing kind of story. So we're just posting that right now.
But that seems perfect. I mean, I'm just saying, I think it seems perfect for the through line of all the films because they all have that at the fundamental core. Can you survive this, the events of what you're watching?
or
right,
not.
Right,
it's a dramatic tension that goes throughout. Even yeah. Rogue, obviously, yeah. all the way through, you know.
Well, right. I was going to say, those films have a sense of groundedness, you know, mm-hmm. and then The Darkness, which you did for us here at Blumhouse, you know, has you delving into the supernatural, which yeah. was interesting, mm-hmm. you know, from the outsider's perspective when I was over at Shock. It was interesting to see guys like you and Alex Aja and stuff who had come up during that era of really grounded, gritty, real world horrors mm. and then kind of take a shot at supernatural, yeah, you know, for mm. you, was that a daunting task to kind of go outside of the comfort zone, or mm-hmm. did you just, you know, talk to me about a little bit about the process of that?
I guess everything's just a different type of story.
Right,
you know,
right.
I don't see it as being, you know, it's funny though, because, you know, Wolf Creek being my first film, you know, there's a kind of presumption that that's kind of what you set out to do.
Sure.
Whereas I could have done anything. Like I could have started with a romantic comedy or a costume drama. It's just a story to tell. That one I made happened to work, and people thought, oh, that's what you do. So it's, you know, that was, I just approached it like trying to work out a way to tell the story. I mean, it's a big challenge, and there's the big decisions to make about how you portray the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that film, you know, was me trying to work it out. Like, I'm definitely want to do another supernatural horror film, because I feel like I made one, I really liked the movie, but I just feel like this, all the way through making it, I'm going, oh God, I want to do this, I want to try this. There's so many more things I wanted to try out. And you know, it's an entirely different thought process mm-hmm. about how to create scares and what actually makes one of those films work really well. But yeah, so there were a lot of challenges, and a lot of them, some I met, some I don't think I did. But I'm very passionate about that kind of storytelling, and I'm developing a couple of other ones because I feel like there's so much more to tell in that space.
Right.
I'm just curious because on top of the jungle and obviously the Belko experiment, which we've been hearing a lot about. I mean, so far most of your films have been things that you've written and created, and I didn't realize how expansive the Wolf Creek universe was. But what is it like to dabble in projects that you didn't write? For example, I mean, James Gunn wrote the Belko experiment, so. You know, how did that happen, getting a piece of material that wasn't yours originally, and how does that differ from doing your own work?
Bit of scripts. by a real writer.
But I mean, you were open to other people's material.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I guess I've become more open in the sense that, you know, I think that, you know, for me, the essence of all great movies or TV is writing. Writing, you know, if you get the writing right, and if you don't completely screw up choosing the director and producer and stuff, it's hard to go that wrong. So script has become increasingly important to me. So while I still write, and there are things that I'm writing and working on, when you read a really mind-blowing, cracking script, it's irresistible because I just got to go for it. Because it's, you know, and The Jungle was written by a guy called Justin Monjo, who's a great Australian screenwriter, and it was just a great script. Belko was the same. You know, I was aware of James's films. I adored, you know, all of his movies. My mind was blown by Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
When I saw a script from James Gunn, I'm like, read it instantly. And then I immediately emailed my agent and said, you know, why are you wasting my time with things that are never going to get made? Because no one in Hollywood is stupid enough to make this movie because it's so so berserk. And he emailed back, said, no, they're making it. It's happening. And it took me a while to understand that he wasn't just, because it's so crazy and so clever, and I thought it's just too smart for, too smart. No one's going to do this. It's going to be screwed up. And then, you know, it's like he's producing it with Peter Safran, who I was a huge fan of the Conjuring movies and Annabelle and stuff. So it was just, you know, I just went in and pitched on it and got to do it. So, but in terms of other writers, my life is spent looking for great writers. You know, mm-hmm. writers are my heroes.
Okay.
And you delving into comic books, you know, did that kind of sate your, you know, the kind of fine art, you know,
right.
side of you?
That's kind of, and actually that's interesting because, you know, that making comic books allows me to stay connected to the visual arts to working with great artists and to, it's visual storytelling like movies, but it's like, and you know, great thing about comics is you can tell the biggest stories you can imagine mm-hmm. and you can tell an epic period story set in 1800s and show the entire world. And it's a way to get those stories out there, but it's also, you know, working with amazing artists and concept artists and illustrators and great writers and stuff. It's just a fun, you know, if I was a billionaire, I'd just have basically a comic book studio, a a movie studio and just be having, because I come from a fine arts background, to me it's all one thing. Mm-hmm. It's all just making stuff, making cool stuff.
When
you're like,
you're a billionaire.
When I'm a billionaire.
Positive
yes.
thinking,
yes.
guys. Positive thinking.
Yes.
We usually kind of wrap by asking, because we're always fascinated, what are you watching? What other of your contemporaries or peers is really turning you on in the horror space? Are you seeing, there's some films that you've seen lately that just really got you, keep you jazzed about it?
I really loved the first Conjuring film. I thought that was a really very important film for horror because it basically told the broader industry of film industry around the world that horror films can be approached in a way that people weren't thinking about. Making a $20 million horror film,
a film yeah.
is a big thing because mm-hmm. There's a perception that, you know, you can just do it cheaply, but they realized that, oh, wow, this is a haunted house movie, but it has all these elements to it. It's made with a level of craft that's really superior. I thought it was a great movie. The second one I thought was, you know, just a kind of like complete kind of, can I say the F word?
Yes.
A complete kind of fuck you to just sort of saying, it was just saying, look how good I am, motherfuckers. Try catch me now. It's such a fuck you. It's like, you know, good luck following this one.
Which is very typical of Australians.
Yeah, I know. And that's like, oh, bloody you son of a bitch. You know, you see the movie and just go, oh, forget it.
Yeah.
It was good fun. And then I think I saw New Blair Witch.
Yeah,
which okay, I don't want to cool. say too much about, but it blew my mind. I thought it was amazing.
That will have been the day before this goes up,
yeah.
so that'd be cool.
Yeah. No, it was really, I mean, you know, I really genuinely, I know, and it's weird to me because there are some people who really hate Blair Witch Project, the original, which I just don't understand because to me it's a seminal piece of filmmaking because, again, it's an experimental movie. These guys experimented with an idea and they got it so right. And it could have been so wrong and so nothing, and we wouldn't even be talking about it ever again. But they got the elements to that scary story and that style of storytelling so perfect that without it, there's no paranormal activity.
I think people
look
back and get mad. Like at the time, no one hated that movie, Paranormal Activity. Those are the kind of movies in the theater at the time scared the bejesus out of you.
Right.
It worked.
Yeah.
It's not meant to necessarily be for repeat viewing. That's not what it's made
for. No, that's right. It's the origin of that kind of movie is kind of the hoax video. It's a trick, you know, that style of movie when it works is basically it's meant to be a hoax, right. And the whole movie was actually the whole presentation of the film was a hoax to the audience. It's a fun game, you know, like the first Paranormal. It's like it's a fun game, and the gag, the deal with the audience is let's pretend this is real and let's see how you can maintain that, and if you break it, it's over. If you get the beats right, and everyone's connected to the concept that they're watching something that's reality, you have, you know, back your truck up to the bank and collect your $400 million.
Yeah.
You know.
All righty. Well, so thank you so much for coming down and giving us so much of your time, being generous.
Where can everybody check out the show?
It's on the Pop Network, and it's screening on October 14th. And they are basically – so they're doing this amazing kind of Halloween programming. So they're basically – they have the Wolf Creek movies. They have a whole bunch of amazing horror films they've programmed, the Saw movies, Haunting in Connecticut, and they're all building up to the premiere of the first episode. Mm. And then they basically roll the episodes after that. But it's a really – they've got an amazing kind of bit of horror curation going on the Pop Network for this Halloween. It's going to be amazing.
And it gives you time to catch up on the movies before the show. Or can you watch the show without the movies? I'm curious the chronologically.
You can.
Will it work?
I know it would totally make sense.
Okay. I think the opening one would be even scarier for you to know who Mick was. When he first pops up, I'd be like, oh, shit.
They may. I think, you know, in terms of the gravity of the character for the series, I think people should watch the first movie. The second movie, just because it's incredibly insane, crazy time. And, you know, but I think, you know, yeah.
Is it chronological from 1-2 to the series? Or could the series be taking place elsewhere?
Or is that a spoiler?
Is that because I don't think I could pick up if
that kind of there's a few little clues in there.
Okay, all right. I have to go back and watch films again.
All righty, well, Greg, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Wolf Creek, October 14th, the series on Pop.
And you can find the Australian Tourism Board online at, which is a very different story than what Greg's peddling.
Yes,
make sure you check that out.
Yes, they're my sponsors, my key sponsors.
All right, thanks for coming down.
We'll see you next week.
Cheers. Thanks, guys. Thank you very much.